Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your hosts, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
Big time card coming up this weekend with UFC 269. I can't wait for it. As always, one half of your host, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, the man himself, Matt Allen, FNP. And listen, Matt, we're in unprecedented times. We're here in December, closing out the year, the wild year that's been in MMA. And we're nearly tied at the end of it. The MVP race is on. Cue the chants, because listen, week in and week out, we have a gaudy yet impressive trophy that we hand out. It has the Canadian flag.
We hand out, but we only ever seem to bring it into frame when Craig wins on the weekend.
Hear me out. I was down by about 11 picks in the middle of the summer,
like
the heat of the summer.
Ago.
And now it's time. We're almost there. This is the MVP trophy. You let us know down below who's going to get it. Regardless, it's a lot of fun. But Matt, all things aside, this card is absolutely banging. This is one of my favorite ones of the year. And listen, if I had a level of excitement for Brad Riddell, Rafael Fiziev last weekend, Kaikeir France taking on Cody Garbrandt, your main event, Dustin Poirier, Charles Oliveira, I can't contain myself. This card is absolutely amazing.
I think I know how to judge a pay-per-view now. If a pay-per-view now has five fights on it that could all individually be their own, like, fight night main event, then that pay-per-view is probably amazing. And I think this card probably has, like, 10 fight night main event-worthy fights. You've got Pedro Munhoz, Dominic Cruz, former champion versus, like, all-time great action fighter. Kara France Garbrandt, like you had mentioned. Jeff Neal, Ponzinibbio, that's a super fun fight between two amazing welterweights. Like, it's a very, very deep card, and this has to be said. There was like a month stretch where, hey, some of the UFC cards might not have been the deepest. They might not have had the best main cards either. But I think we do have to give the UFC their flowers right now. The last three pay-per-view events that we have been given, it all started with, what, Jan versus Glover, and then Colby versus Usman. Now we have Poirier versus Oliveira. Like, this has been an absolutely amazing stretch of cards that we've had.
18 ranked fighters on this card. I mean, 15 fights scheduled now. I'm not overly sure what's going to happen with Jillian Roberts and Priscilla Cachoeira. The only reason I say that is because at UFC Fight Night Font versus Aldo, they showed the graphic of the undercard. That fight was not on it, but on Sunday there was Instagram posts from Robertson and Cachoeira, so unless something happened that I don't know of, I'm going to assume that the fight's still on. We'll still talk about it, but I just want to get those housekeeping notes out of the way before we really get too far into it. It's such an amazing card. It's hard to pick these out, but let's throw it on over to our Fight of the Night screen, as always presented by Manscaped. Check them out at manscaped.com. Use promo code FNP. You're going to get 20% off your order and free shipping. Let's throw it on over to the Fight of the Night screen.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the Fight of the Night with Fight Night Picks.
And when we're talking about a possible fight of the night, I mean, Pedro Munhoz, Dominic Cruz, listen, the 5-1 in for both guys. For Munhoz, 2-3. For Dominic Cruz, 3-2. But you know that these little rascals are down to throw down, and these guys at 135 are two of the most impressive strikers with wrestling and grappling in their back pockets, and that's what makes this fight so much fun. I can't wait for it.
From Young Punisher to Little Rascal, that'd be great if Pedro Munhoz walked out with that as his nickname. I think this is a phenomenal fight. We've seen Munhoz in so many 5-round fights now, but they're normally in that fight night atmosphere. This is a great opportunity for him to kind of get back to the top of the division. I know Dominic Cruz is the same, like, prime championship caliber fighter he used to be, but he still has a massive name, and he's very, very fun to watch, so I don't know how this fight cannot deliver.
Should be absolutely amazing. Now, the second one is going to be a contentious pick, because Jeff Neal Ponzinibbio is going to be an amazing fight. Blindado, Bruno Silva, and Jordan Wright. Somebody's getting knocked out in that fight. It was like last weekend's Maki Bitolo and Dusko Todorovic. Listen, there's so many good fights on this card, but at 100% focus, fit, and ready, Cody Garbrandt is a walking highlight reel. Now, in his last fight, he didn't look overly great against Rob Font, who had an interesting fight against Jose Aldo last weekend, but this is Cody Garbrandt's move down to 125 pounds. We're going to see if it works out. Taking on a guy that matches fire with fire in Kaikeir France, this should be, on paper, an amazing fight. Do you think Cody Garbrandt just walks around with a bunch of white snake behind him? I don't know where I'm going, but I do know where I've been. Because it's been a weird career for Cody Garbrandt. He was almost like, oh, you're the next cash cow Conor McGregor when he beat Dominic Cruz. Like, those were the heights and the expectations that were set for Garbrandt. And it's been sort of a weird run for him. It's had a lot of injuries. He's had a rivalry with TJ Dillashaw. And now he's moving down to 125 pounds. It just seems like there's been a lot of changes in this stage of Garbrandt's career. It would be nice to just see him look good at 125. No matter what the result is, just if Garbrandt actually looked like the fighter who fought Dominic Cruz down at 125 pounds, I think this will be a great fight.
Yeah, and I mean, for Cody Garbrandt, you want the white snake to continue as soon as he gets punched clean in the face. Here I go again on my own! And he gets drawn into the brawl. So it should be an amazing fight. You want to talk about a one-hitter quitter, a one-round guy, Kai Kara-France is your guy. So this fight should be absolutely amazing. You let us know down below in the comments section who you have in your fight of the night, because last weekend it was Cheyenne Velismus, Mallory Martin. Who would have thunk it? Big-time card coming up this weekend. Manscaped. Check them out. Manscaped.com. Use promo code FNP. You're going to get 20% off your order and free shipping. Boy, do we have a card coming up for you. And if we even look at the main event for this card, 54 UFC fights between these guys, 29 bonuses. And for Charles Oliveira, at one point, he has one of those, like, you know, double up bonuses where you got a performance bonus and a fight of the night back when that used to be a thing. But we have an amazing card coming up this weekend. Like I said, 15 total fights. My personal favorite fight on this card, if we're being honest,
the main event.
Josh Emmett, Dan Ige, because it's the return of my guy, a guy with cinder blocks in his hands, and I have a lot to say about that fight. Matt, what's yours? Main event?
The best jiu-jitsu player in the UFC is about to fight the best boxer in the UFC. This is like 1998, but they're also very good at every other aspect. Like, that's how good this main event is this weekend. I'm fired up about this card, and we barely even talked about the main and co-main event. Amanda Nunes is fighting this weekend. One of the greatest female athletes of our generation of all time is going to go out there and be able to do what she does best. I know I always get really excited for a Nunes fight, similar to when like Aldo fought last night. It just feels like there's something extra there because you know you are watching history every time they are in the cage. And then, like I said, for the main event, if Dustin Poirier can finally get a UFC title, it's going to be up there with, like, Jan Blachowicz, Glover Teixeira, Michael Bisping, like, along those lines of, you have gone through the absolute ringer to get to this opportunity, and if he can finally win it, it'll just be a great story all around. But for Charles Oliveira, this guy's faced a crap ton of adversity throughout his career. Fought at featherweight, fought at lightweight. Everybody's counted him out every single step of the way, but now he's UFC champion. So I don't know how this main event can't deliver. And I know a lot of people who might not even really know who Charles Oliveira is still feel very excited about this fight because they know how good Poirier is from the Conor fights. They're sort of familiar with Oliveira, especially after this last year that he's had. So I think this is going to be a great pay-per-view card.
What's it going to be? Poirier McGregor 4? Will it be Oliveira versus Gaethje, or maybe even a move back down to 145 like he seems to want to tease?
He loves saying that.
Volkanovski, I can't wait for it in your co-main event. Nunes defending that bantamweight strap, which hasn't happened in, what, a blue moon, really, taking on the Pacific Northwest Venezuelan vixen, Juliana Pena. Can't wait for it. Big-time card. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. One of the strangest fights on this entire card between unranked flyweights, we have the savage Canadian Jillian Robertson. She's taking on Zombie Girl Priscilla Cachoeira, which makes me think of Living Dead Girl by Rob Zombie, which makes me think of Courtney Casey, who's in this division that walked out to that her last time out, and she won her fight. So that's an omen of things to come. Priscilla Cachoeira might win this fight. But the reason why I say that this is the strangest fight on this card is because Zombie Girl's won her last two fights by knockout, and she's a plus 283 average underdog on best fight odds, taking on Jillian Robertson, who's gotten beat at her own game in her last two fights against good fighters, but she's gotten beat at her own game in her last two fights on a two-fight losing streak. And if you look at it this way, for Cachoeira in her five-on-in, as we call it with Fight Night Picks, her fifth-to-last fight, she got her face beat in by Valentina Shevchenko in a fight that kind of ushered out Mario Yamasaki from the UFC. That's realistically what happened. Now, it might seem like that was years ago,
And it is, because that fight took place 3 years and 9 months ago. Then she fights Molly McCann and loses. Then she fights Luana Carolina and loses. She beats Matt's favorite fighter, Shayna Dobson, who he had to apologize to profusely at one point.
She lit her on fire, though.
And then Priscilla beat Gina Mazzani in one of the oddest fights I've ever seen. It reminded me of Rafa Garcia and Chris Gritzmacher. It reminded me of Leonardo Santos, Clay Guida, because the first round was all Gina Mazzani. She took over. The fight was almost over. And then in the second round, Gina had no cardio left. And at one point, she just kind of gave up her defenses and Priscilla pounded away to earn the standing TKO victory. So, Matt, I say this to you. Where is the respect for Priscilla here?
She's not getting any, and I think it's a damn shame. I really do, because here's the thing. I was sold a false bill of goods on Jillian Robertson, or maybe I invested irresponsibly into her stock, because early on in her UFC career, I had high hopes for her. She had a really good wrestling game. She was a back taker. Her game was sort of reminiscent of like Kevin Lee almost. It was like, okay, I'm going to take you down, get to your back, go for the submission. And in theory, that's a really good game. I like that a lot. You can go out there, you can get finishes, put a pace on people. And really, when you think about the Hall of Fame version of Jillian Robertson, that is sort of the fighter that you were at least thinking she was going to become. But like you had mentioned, it's not the fact that now she's getting outstruck and people are defending her takedowns and that's how she's losing fights. Now she's getting taken down. She doesn't have great takedown defense. She's getting out scrambled. And that's the thing that we see a lot. Wrestlers oftentimes will have great offensive wrestling, but when they're on their back, they do struggle sometimes. I know I bring up Sarah McMahon all the time for this. It's like a leatherback turtle. Like, yeah, they're big, they're really cool, but if they're on their back, they can't really do anything. And for Robertson, that's sort of the situation with her. And it's a really weird fight, and the odds are very, very puzzling, because Robertson, to me, does a lot of the same things Gina Mazzani does. It's a lot of offensive takedowns. I wouldn't say their striking is all that similar. I will say that they're both somewhat uncomfortable on the feet, though. I wouldn't say either one's some big stand-up striker is going to go out there and win a lot of fights just being contested on the feet. But Robertson's going to need the takedown early. She's going to have to put some kind of volume together to actually get that takedown. I just look at her as a smaller fighter than Mazzani was, and I don't really think she has that much better cardio than Mazzani, so let's say Robertson does get off to a really good start. Can she at least sustain that for a total of 15 minutes? I think she'll have a better time doing that than Mazzani did, but I still question, okay, can she put that kind of a pace on for 15 minutes?
Disagree. Just where Mazzani coming down from 135 to 125, that was definitely a little bit of an issue. Now, did she fight Rachel Ostovich that way? And was she able to get the win? Yeah, she was.
Does that mean a lot to us, though?
I mean, that's a callback of a hollaback right there, if you want to go Gwen Stefani's way. But Matt, when I look at this one, for Priscilla, she gets these wins. Now, the Mazzani fight was weird. The Shayna Dobson fight was predictable. So now we're here. If you look at Priscilla Cachoeira's stat line, which I actually suggest in this case that you do, because we have a large enough sample size, it's a mess. 3.81 significant strikes per minute to 7.03 absorbed. The reason why is because when she fought Valentina Shevchenko, now I'm going from significant strikes to total strikes, but let's go with total strikes and have fun with it. She was outstruck 230-3. Molly McCann, 110-77. Luana Carolina, 129-69. Priscilla got dominated in those three fights. Honest to goodness, halfway surprised that she was even in a fight with Shayna Dobson, because that figured to be, you know, you lose three that way, you're done, bud. But no, she's still here. And for Jillian Robertson, again, her 5-on-in, she's 2-3. We look at the losses against Macy Barber, against Tyler Santos, against Miranda Maverick. We look at the wins over Courtney Casey. There's a callback.
And she has been trading a lot with Miranda Maverick ever since their fight. If you peep them on the Instagram, they actually get along really well, which is nice to see after they fought. And they have been training together.
Hannah Goldie as well, who can kind of stick and move when she's at her best, then offers up a good look on the feet when you compare her to Priscilla Cachoeira. So we mentioned the odds for this one. If we want to go deep and dirty for Cachoeira, open a plus 250, plus 283 right now. For Robertson, open a minus 300, minus 370 as it is. Matt, we're over on Tapology. We haven't looked at the total votes. I'm going to set the over-under at 80% Robertson. What do you say?
I think they're going to be lower, and I only say this for this reason. I think the casual fan who might not watch a lot of MMA might be the ones who put the money on it, but I think the Tapology voters are a little bit more in tune with it.
Ah! 679 total votes, 66% Robertson, 36% by decision, 58% by submission. For the 34% that have Cachoeira, 51% by decision, 35% by knockout. Matt, I look at this fight. Jillian Robertson ostensibly fighting for her UFC career. Priscilla Cachoeira looking to catch another body.
I guess I'm going to ask you a question before I give my final prediction. Who do you think has improved the most since their UFC debut? Because I feel
neither.
Like... But that's what I mean. I feel like the obvious answer would be, oh, Robertson has. She's the younger athlete. She came in. But she's very much the exact same fighter that she was when she initially came over who fought Molly McCann. And for Priscilla, she just looked so bad in her first fight, you never really knew what you were going to get. But if you go back and watch her regional scene fights, like, she's still pretty much the same fighter. She throws massive power behind her punches. If they land, she'll probably win. If they don't, she'll get tired and get taken down a lot. I rarely make my prediction based off the odds, and I say, oh, I'm going to pick the underdog because I feel like this fight's a lot closer than the odds suggest. I'm going to have to do that for this fight. Jillian Robertson has shown zero defensive striking capabilities throughout her UFC career. She does get hit quite a bit on the feet, and against some fighters in this division, it's not that big of a deal. You can eat a couple shots, get taken down, and that'll be it. But against Priscilla Cachoeira, she's not the most skilled fighter in the division, but she does have power. It's one of the few things I feel comfortable with saying that she does have a lot of, and I don't know if Robertson can eat that power consistently throughout this fight. Now, could this be one of those fights where Priscilla hurts Robertson in the first round? Maybe it looks really good early and similar to like you had mentioned with Leonardo Santos last night. Just gets tired. We see Robertson slowly take over. Yeah, that could happen. But I don't think Robertson's going to be able to get through that initial flurry.
I like Robertson in this fight because for Priscilla Cachoeira, 63% takedown defense in those five fights. We've seen her at points where A, her cardio's not bad and she's able to come back in certain fights. Or B, she just gets taken down and has a really hard time getting back up. So I'm going to take the Robertson that I've seen. But again, this is troubling. Robertson in the UFC, 6-4, 5 or 6 wins by finish, 4 of them by submission. She competed 3 times in 2019, 3 times in 2020. This is just her second fight in 2021. So we'll have to see if the time off between her last loss to now, she's been able to make moves, start grooves before they knew we were gone. At camp, a gambler's jiu-jitsu and mixed martial arts.
It would have been nice if she stayed with ATT. That's
Matt,
what I'm going to say.
We'll see what happens. I've got the Canadian here in Jillian Robertson. You're going with Brazil's Priscilla Cachoeira. Knock wood, this fight's actually on the card because the graphic at Font Aldo did not have it on the prelims.
Yeah, we might be talking to no one right now.
We'll see what happens, but overall we have a great card headlined by 2 big-time title fights that you're not going to want to miss, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
If this fight were a song, it would be All the Mad Men by David Bowie. If this fight were a sporting event, it would be like the 2011 Boston Red Sox. Listen, you can come for this video and expect me to tell you that Randy Koss is going to win, but it's not that easy. It could get weird. And like All the Mad Men, the bridge is just odd. So now we have this fight between the Zohan and Primetime. And listen, Tony Kelly, it's like those bullseyes that our old baseball manager used to smoke, and then he'd go out, get hit by a pitch, get thrown out of the game, and then curse the umpire all the way to his car just to pull out of the parking lot angrily when we're losing 15-0. This is exactly that type of fight. And for Randy Costa, his UFC run's been weird because realistically he's an uber prospect. He's very long for this division. He's got great pop at the end of his shots. His cardio's a little sus when he throws the kitchen sink at a person in the first round. And other than that, he's a very, very solid fighter who, since making the move down to Sanford MMA a year ago, we'll throw the picture up there, is 0-1, and he's only had the Adrian Yanez fight. He was a Lozon's guy, he's a Massachusetts guy, and so far the UFC career has been a mixed bag of goods. He has a loss to Brandon Davis that was on short notice by submission. Brandon Davis, back in the UFC. He has wins over Boston Solomon and Jurny Newsome. And then he has that loss to Adrian Yanez about 4 months ago. Loses by TKO. Matt, that's Randy Costa in a nutshell. What have you liked so far out of Costa in the UFC?
He's been memorable, and I think that has to be said. Because how many fighters have just come through, they've had some exciting fights, and then 5 fights into their career, you just sort of, you lose track of them, I guess. And then you're watching a Bellator event, and you're like, oh my goodness, Sam Cecilia's over here now? I don't think Randy Costa is going to be one of those types of fighters. Like, he is too unique. Now, I said this last week about Brendan Allen, so hey, maybe I don't know what I'm talking about. But Costa at least has sort of made his own role in the UFC, and that's a really nice thing to see out of a guy who's only been here for 4 fights, because most people, when they're 4 fights in, they might have 2 wins, 2 losses, and you're kind of fighting for your job in your next fight. For me,
That's not what this fight is for Randy Costa. This is like, hey, if you win, you're right back on track, and then maybe we'll give you another, like, top 20 to 25 guy, and then we'll reassess at that point. Because for Costa, I'll get back to what I've liked out of him. I do really like the output. I do really like the kicks. I like his ability to really switch up his punches with his kicks in combination on the feet. He's not somebody who goes into, like, oh, now I'm in punching mode, now I'm in kicking mode. He's really good at mixing everything together, especially with his stand-up. I'll get to the cardio point, though, because I do think that is a really interesting point. I'm going to bury this point home because I think it's important. I don't think Costa has bad cardio. I just don't think he paces himself all that well. He's in that Paulo Costa conversation where it's like, hey, if you didn't throw 400 punches in a round, maybe you wouldn't be tired at the next one. So for Costa, I do think he just has to find his own Goldilocks zone where it's okay. I was a little too hot against Adrian Yanez, at least early on. I was a little too cold, at least early on in the second round of that fight. So what is the perfect Costa sort of work rate? Now, it'll be really interesting to see what his style and what his game plan is against Tony Kelly, because Kelly's going to employ a lot of the same strengths that Costa has in the cage. He's also a guy who likes to work behind his volume. He is somebody who will mix his punches in with his kicks. I just really worry about one thing with Tony Kelly. He doesn't block the body very much at all. He likes that really high guard. And with Costa's kicks, he's always going to the leg, to the body, to the head. He really is a three-level striker. And I do think that those body shots are going to be a huge key to this fight.
Kelly's one of those guys that might not defend the body overly well because he can really rely on the fact that, hey, I can just go out, catch a kick, take the guy down, and then I'm going to dominate on the mat. And Kelly's one of those interesting fighters out of Soul Fighters, Louisiana. There's the, I almost said Adrian Lee. Not Adrian Lee, Andrea Lee connection that's there, and a really good gym there as well, training with Alon Cruz, of all people nowadays. And let's give shouts to his coaches, because he's got Wayne Knudsen as well as Andy Carrington. So shouts where it's due. The weirdest thing for Tony Kelly coming into this fight, and I implore you to watch the interview that he did with the All-Star and formerly our own JHK MMA, still doing the damn thing, friend of the show, exclusive man over there, because he talks about the fact that he's been out for a very long time. He's supposed to have a fight against Trevin Jones this past summer, but he tore his rotator cuff. And JHK doesn't just leave it there, because I couldn't figure out why Kelly withdrew from that fight. So this is my first time finding out. He presses him on it. He says, you know, had to go through some alternative therapies, had to kind of change some things in training. I really like to fight behind the jab. I had to find a different way to now fight behind the jab.
Did he get medical advice from Joe Rogan?
I don't know about any of that, and I have no comment. However, all I do have to say about it is rotator cuff injuries in baseball can be career ending. In MMA, at 34, almost 35, it's definitely not a good thing. So hopefully for Tony Kelly, he's coming back, he's fit and ready, he's taking the time off and away. And listen, he came into the UFC with a fight of the night against Kai Kamaka. Very exciting fighter that, listen, he's in his second stint with Bellator, but he could probably fight some decent UFC fighters. Like Kai Kamaka.
He went 0-3. I'm sorry. Kai Kamaka
1-2 with a draw, so good job. But regardless, Tony Kelly can fight behind the jab, can throw a good kick of his own. He's a very well-rounded fighter. He fought a great level of competition before the UFC. There were a lot of long layoffs, but he had a win over Levi Mowles, a loss to Kevin Aguilar, but a big-time fight against Kevin Aguilar. And that fight was, again, years ago. Split decision loss 5 years, 4 months ago. Andy Brossett he beats 2 years ago, loses to Kamaka, then he beats Ali Al-Kaizi. Here's the point that I have to make about both of these guys. Ali Al-Kaizi went 0-2 in the UFC. For Randy Costa out of his wins, he beat Boston Solomon, went 0-2 in the UFC, but beat Ricky Tercios on Contender Series to get in. Ricky, where are you at? And then, again, his other fight that he had was against Journey Newsome, a win, but Journey's 0-2 in the UFC with a no contest that was a knockout of Domingo Plarte. So realistically, for both of these guys, and for Costa, his level of competition out of his wins before coming into the UFC, their combined record was 5-14. The competition hasn't been there. The bare bone skills are there for Costa, for sure. For Kelly, very well-rounded. That rotator cuff injury scares me to bits. I can't pick him in this fight for that reason.
I think we have to speak, though, too. Costa still looked good in losing performances, and that does matter. Like, you can't just look at the wins and losses and judge them just based on the green and the red. I'm colorblind. But With Costa, at least he looked good against Yanez early on, put a pace on him, and showed skills that I do think he can replicate in this fight with Kelly. If he goes out there and uses the jab in a similar manner that he did against Yanez in this fight, I think he's going to have a lot of success. And the thing about Costa is that he can fight on the outside, he can fight on the inside, but I like him a lot more on the outside. And if he is mixing in that long jab with the kicks, I think he's going to be able to outpoint Tony Kelly quite comfortably.
Randy Costa open at par. Both these guys open at par. For Randy Costa, he's now a minus 205 favorite on best fight odds. For Tony Kelly, he's now a plus 168 or thereabouts. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprised us, they are to you. Ooh. 689 total votes, 92% Costa, 74% by knockout for the 8% that have Kelly, 56% by decision. Maybe you like Kelly by decision. I think that's the only way that I would go with him. Kind of the way I was thinking last weekend. Morono, decision. Kelly, if he's going to win, decision. If Costa's going to win, he can get it done in a lot of different ways. I like Randy Costa in this fight because, again, that rotator cuff injury scares me way too much for Tony Kelly.
Also, the fact that he's 34, almost 35 in this division isn't helping him a lot either. And Costa's a really exciting prospect. Like, I know he lost to Brandon Davis, but that was a really exciting fight. And for that being your UFC debut, especially at the time with how good Davis was at that point in time, too. I know he got cut shortly after, but still, Brandon Davis, at least in that moment, had won a couple of fights, and there was a little bit of Brandon Davis hype. I know it's hard to believe that now, but still, at the time there was. I do think Costa's got this one in the bag.
Both of us going with Massachusetts' own, now in Florida, Randy Costa. You let us know below who you have in this fight. You're not going to want to miss it because, listen, at the top, couple of big title fights, bantamweight strap on the line, and your lightweight belt as well. You're not going to want to miss, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Absolute banger in a grappler's paradise, as you know, the wizard Ryan Hall looks to get back on his roll. He's taking on Glory Fitness and MMA's own Derek Minner, a man cut from the same cloth. He loves to grab the submission. And listen, if you want a perfect Derek Minner fight to go back when you're doing your tape study in preparation for Ryan Hall, remember that time as a giant underdog when he fought the young Canadian TJ Laramie? Not far from here in Ontario, Canada, there's one but not two Laramies, and I wish they would fight more often. For Derek Minner, well, he went in there and snatched that win up very quickly. It was a great win, and he's one of those guys that, if you watch a Derek Minner fight, go watch his fight against Terrence McKinney if you want a good one. Minner fought an insane level of competition on the regional scene. That McKinney win, they had both already been on Contender Series. They highlighted and headlined a big-time card in Nebraska. And for Minner, he accepts the takedown, and then he gets the submission. He's one of those slippery guys that has deceiving strength when it comes to being on the mat and very interesting wrestling. He'll give up position to maybe gain a submission at a certain point. Doesn't necessarily work against a Ryan Hall, but in a lot of Minner fights, he's able to do that. Now, is he susceptible to getting submitted himself? 110% he is. He primarily loses by submission. He's a killer be killed type of grappler. But he brings an interesting challenge to Ryan Hall, who, in his last fight, fought a guy that's similar in that respect in Ilya Topuria, where when he grapples, it's all power, it's all fury. Ilya Topuria grapples in this division like you saw William Knight and Alonzo Menifield grapple in their last fight. It's power and fury, and somebody's getting messed up. However, Ilya also happens to be one of the best boxers in this division. And for the triple threat that is Ilya Topuria, he made Ryan Hall look kind of pedestrian. So now we come into this fight where Derek Minner's not Ilya Topuria whatsoever. He has the grappling, he has the wrestling, but he doesn't have the striking that Topuria has at all. So Ryan Hall gets a big opportunity to represent 50-50 and come in here and make this not necessarily a 50-50 fight and get another W on his record. And Ryan Hall had a giant win streak. He was the Leonardo Santos of this division. Now we're here, Matt. This is an interesting fight. I love it. What are you saying here?
This is an awful fight for Derek Minner. Like, probably the worst fight in the whole entire division for him. And I know people look at Ryan Hall and it's like, hey, he's kind of nerdy. He just looks like a regular guy. What's so special about him? I'm here to tell you what's so special about him. Do you like the ligaments in your legs the way that they are? Probably. I'm guessing you do.
There are people in Peru like Claudio Poyas that have posters of this guy on their ceiling when they're thinking of pulling knee bars and such.
Nothing but world-class strikers in Peru. Here's the thing about Ryan Hall. If you are trying to grapple him, you're not going to win. I don't care who you are. I don't care what your name is in this division. If you go out there and grapple with Ryan Hall, you're going to lose at the end of the day. The difference was Ilya Topuria was able to strike and strike with power when Ryan Hall was going for those wonky takedown attempts because they were weird. He doesn't go for single legs. He doesn't go for double legs. He goes for weird hip trips. He goes for weird, like, scissor takedowns like Joe Lozon used to do. Like, it is all very unorthodox. But Derek Minner needs takedowns to win his fights. He does not win his fights on the feet ever. It's always that killer be killed kind of grappling style. And Minner's kind of weird. He's not a catch wrestler, but his style does remind me a little bit of catch wrestling, where it's not just like, okay, I'm attacking with triangles off my back. It's a lot of head and arm chokes. It's a lot of you really feeling his force and feeling his pressure to then open up those submissions. My problem with all that, though, is that stuff doesn't work against Ryan Hall. And Ryan Hall, if you give him an inch on the ground, he is going to take a mile. And when you bring up the fact that Minner not only loses by submission, he loses by a wide variety of submissions, too. It's not just like he's susceptible to rear naked chokes or arm bars. He's been submitted in a wide variety of ways. You know what the really cool thing about Ryan Hall is? He doesn't just need a arm bar. He doesn't need a leg lock or a rear naked choke. He can submit you any way possible. And not just in a cage, he can submit straight up jiu-jitsu guys in jiu-jitsu tournaments and do it pretty much any way possible. Like, that's how high level the grappling of Ryan Hall is. So I know a lot of people might be down on him based on his last performance against Topuria, but I don't know if you saw, ESPN just released their, like, top 25 under 25 ratings for, or rankings for MMA. Number one was Song Yadong. I can agree with that. He's very good. He's still very young. Number two, Ilya Topuria. Like, that's the type of caliber of fighter that we're talking about when we bring up Topuria. So just because Hall looked bad against him, I don't think he will against Minner.
If you're an early Fight Night Picks fan from 2018, you'll know Ilya Topuria. You also knew Ramiz Brahimi, who's in the UFC now. Like, there were some names out there very, very early on. Piotr Jan was on that list too. But when we look at this fight, yeah, I mean, I talked about the level of competition for Derek Minner, and I mentioned the wins that he had outside of the UFC. Terrence McKinney was one. Here's some of the losses. Herbert Burns on Contender Series, Kevin Kroom, Jordan Griffin, who else? Chico Camus, Jesse Arnett, Canada's own, Luke Sanders. Like, the list really goes on. He had a win over Clay Collard on the regional scene. That's pretty cool. For Ryan Hall, the 5-1 in. Artem Lobov, the win almost 6 years ago. Gray Maynard, Darren Elkins, Ilya Topuria, a BJ fight Penn there as well. BJ Penn. And if you want to play MMA math, Ryan Hall beat Darren Elkins, and Darren Elkins beat Derek Minner in one of the most emotional post-fight interviews I've seen in a long time. The guy's just doing it for his family, Darren Elkins. He's no longer the damage. He's graduated to, I don't know,
the family man.
Family man, plant supervisor. He's no longer on the ground floor. But Matt, when I look at this fight, Derek Minner coming in here at a plus 178 underdog as it sits right now. Open a plus 220, so he's gained a little bit. Ryan Hall open a minus 260, he's minus 221. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, 718 total votes, 80% Hall, 83% by submission for the 20% that have Minner, 52% decision, 29% by knockout. The 29% of the fans that have Derek Minner to win by knockout only watched Ryan Hall's last fight and only looked at the record on the page. Matt, in this fight, I have Ryan Hall. I have certain reservations. I mean, again, Derek Minner's a strong character for this division.
But this is the thing. When you use strength, you get tired faster.
Does
and
not
you get
beat finesse.
No, exactly. Like, strength beats a lot of things. But Luka Doncic has my favorite quote ever. And it's that, I'd rather miss small than miss big because I'm not a great athlete. Like, scoring in America is easier than scoring in Europe because you rely on your athleticism in North America and you don't in Europe. You just rely on your technique. Technique is always going to beat just brute athleticism. And I know Ryan Hall, he's a little bit older. He's wonky. And I'm not even saying this fight's going to look good until he wins. He's probably going to be doing a lot of weird stuff that's going to make all of his face palm against their TVs. But he's probably going to get some wonky submission and probably look amazing.
I wouldn't listen to a damn thing Luka Doncic says. He's like a 1970s hockey player when training camp was training camp and you smoke grits on the bench. Matt, for me,
Luka Doncic.
Both of us actually going with the man himself, the wizard, Ryan Hall, in this fight. If you can make a compelling argument either way, we want to hear from you down below in the comments section. Make sure you check us out on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher, maybe? Spotify? Wherever you listen to your podcast, because we are out there. You can find us at Fight Night Picks. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say,
let's get into it.
Very interesting fight coming up this weekend at Flyweight. We have Alex Perez coming off of his UFC 250 title shot back over a year ago against Deiveson Figueiredo, and he's taking on a bit of a scuffling Matt Schnell, who's 1-2 in his last three fights, his one win by split decision. So let me set it up here, and hopefully I do a pretty good job with the setup. You might think you peeped the scene. You haven't. The real one's far too mean. Matt, that's one of your favorite songs. Maybe it's one of somebody else's favorite songs out there. And I hope that that's a good setup, because I think Nicki Minaj did a pretty good job on that Kanye West track. This is how I'm going to set this one up. Alex Perez is the best fighter that we've seen off of Dana White's Contender Series. If you want to argue with me, fine. You might not even realize he came off Contender Series, because it has been a while, as Stained once said, if you want more music references. If you look at it for Perez, his UFC losses, he's been 6-2 so far. The losses to Joe B and Figueiredo. He went on a wild win streak to get that title shot over Mark De La Rosa, Jordan Espinosa, and Jussie Formiga, my favorite Brazilian at 125. And listen, if you look at those last two wins that he had, Espinosa and Formiga, both bonus worthy, and he picked up those 50 G's, baby, and he gets a title shot, and he looked bad. He looked very bad in that
fight. No, he didn't. He hurt Figueiredo early. His striking was looking good. Then he got submitted by a guillotine.
He got finished in the first round. I have this to say. He got finished in the first round. It's definitely not a good showing. It left a bad taste in my mouth when you lose that quick. However, for Matt Schnell, it's been a weird run. I mean, I expect so much out of Max Schnell, because when I look at him, maybe I pronounce his name Max Schnell. Maybe I meant to say Matt Schnell. I'm so excited about the fight. But when I look at the guy whose nickname is Danger, he's kill or be killed. He's 5-4 in the UFC. 5 of 9 of those fights ending by finish, some by his own doing, some not. He struggles against certain guys. Like, he's just a wonky fighter. I'd really like to get your take on Matt Schnell.
But this has to be said. Have you ever seen a boring Matt Schnell fight?
No.
I certainly haven't. Like, that's the really fun thing. He's just so well-rounded, I guess. That's the best way to bring up Matt Schnell. He's like Brad Pitt in the movie Troy. The problem is, his Achilles is his durability. Because Schnell, is he a good grappler? Yeah, he's a really good grappler. He can get submissions, he can get out of submissions, he can scramble, defend takedowns, and get his own takedowns. So I would say he's a pretty good grappler. Can he strike? Well, yeah, he's got a really nice high guard. He has good volume. I wouldn't say it's great, and he has good power. I wouldn't say it's great. He's sort of in that, I hate saying it's the Paul Felder category, but I feel like people do understand what I say when I say this, where he's not like a 10 out of 10. He can't really knock you out with one punch, but he doesn't have to hit you with like 100 shots like Max Holloway. He's kind of in that in between where I strike in combination and I'm susceptible to being hit. And that's the big problem with Schnell. For him to have his most success, he has to stand in that pocket and throw some big bombs. Now, to his credit, he does have pretty good power for the division, so if he lands, he's going to hurt his opponent. The problem is that I feel like his biggest weakness, honestly, is just he stands in the pocket for 1 second too long, and he's just bitten him so many times at this stage of his career. Like, in the Pantoja fight, he hurts Pantoja with a big shot, gets a little overexcited, and the second he opens himself, even an inch, Pantoja hits him with a big shot, puts him down. It's just sort of been that story throughout his career. It's Schnell's looking really good, and I hate to frame it this way, but this is almost the case where it's like, okay, he's looking really good, and then he finds a way to lose, or at least the opportunity opens itself up. And even his win over Tyson Nam, it was starting to go down a bit of a bad road by the end of that fight. He started out really strong, but midway through the second, he's being tagged by some clean shots on the outside, and midway through the third, the same thing has to be said. Now, getting hit clean by Tyson Nam a couple of times isn't the end of the world. Like, Nam's a really, really good striker.
Ask Zaruka. Got a shift.
Exactly. He's a really good striker. And honestly, if anything, that shows that Schnell isn't the least durable fighter in this division, because he was able to eat some big shots against Nam. So that proves a few things to me. I just don't know what his answer is going to be for the leg kicks and just the overall hooks and power of Alex Perez, because Perez is a really unique fighter where he is very dedicated to the leg kick, similar to like Chris Gutierrez, where he will just spam it. And I mean spam it, like UFC 4 style. Keep on hitting circle like there's no tomorrow. But this is going to be sacrilegious, but I would say his leg kicks are kind of similar to Jose Aldo. A little bit. Like, he goes to the calf, he goes to the thigh, he can mix it up. And for Perez, he only needs 2 or 3 of them to really make a big difference in the fight. This is why I say he didn't look that bad against Figueiredo. Yes, he got finished in the first round, but in the first 3 minutes of that fight, he was lighting Figueiredo up on the feet. He was doing something that I did not expect from Perez, so I feel like I do have to at least give him credit for the few short moments he had success against Figueiredo on the feet.
So when I look at this fight again, for Matt Schnell, 5-4 in the UFC, 3 of those 4 losses by knockout. He debuted against Rob Font at Tough Tournament of Champions, the finale, so it's been a little while. But yeah, I mean, when I look at it, for Perez, 5 of his 6 wins in the UFC octagon by finish. This is a guy, again, the leg kicks are there. The wrestling's there. Timo Yama tends to come up with a pretty good game plan. Now, for Luis Smolka last weekend, no, Vince Morales, let's go! Give me that dub. But when I look at that fight, yeah, I mean, listen, Louis Smolka is a kill or be killed fighter. Sometimes stuff like that is going to happen. So when I look at the odds for this fight, Perez opened a minus 300 favorite. He's a minus 328 right now. If we look at it for Schnell, open a plus 250, plus 252 or thereabouts. If we have a look at Tapology for the votes on this one, that's a surprise. 677 total votes, 92% Perez, 67% by decision. For the 8% that have Schnell, 58% by decision, and 34% by submission. I think Matt Schnell's got a way better chance than the odds and the Tapology voters would suggest, because this guy is so well-rounded. His chin's been an issue in the past. Alex Perez opens things up, though, by throwing a leg kick, soften that up, take away the boxing and the tools and the movement of Schnell, and then he can start to work up top, rip the body. Is Alex Perez Jose Aldo 2.0 at 125? No. He shares some of those qualities, though. But I do like Perez for his overall game plan and his durability, but I got to give credit where it's due. I think Matt Schnell does have a better opportunity than things would suggest here.
I think he does, but I do like how you set this up. The way Perez's game is built is to slow you down with the leg kicks and make you more available to be hit later on in the fight. If Perez is able to pull that game plan off, he should be able to beat Matt Schnell. If you can slow down the movement of Schnell and just make him a more available target to hit, eventually one of your big shots should land on him. And the thing about Perez, too, he's a great wrestler. We haven't even really brought that up. Like, if it really does come down to grappling, Perez, more often than not, is probably going to be the one ending up in the top position between these two. Now, I wouldn't recommend grappling all that much with Matt Schnell, because he's a phenomenal grappler and he has great submission ability, even off of his back. But I do think that has to be said, too, how although Perez has shown that he is a very good striker and he's made massive improvements in his striking, he still is a great grappler himself.
Both of us going with California's own Alex Perez to get the win. You let us know down below. Listen, are the odds makers, are the people, are Fight Night picks, are we sleeping on Schnell? I think he's got a pretty good opportunity in this one to bring back the win for Louisiana, as does one half of your main event, the man himself, Dustin Poirier, taking on Charles Oliveira. You're not going to want to miss it, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
It's almost like Erin Blanchfield was in high school. She was writing a test at her little desk, and she kept peeking over to the other side. She was cheating on somebody's Scantron sheet, so then they just gave her another multiple choice. Because she goes from one difficult test to the next. Erin Blanchfield originally scheduled to be taking on Macy Barber this weekend. Barber out, in steps Miranda Maverick. Now, the fight fell apart about a month ago, so each lady has known about this one for some time. But neither won an easy test for Blanchfield, and I have this to say. Why cannibalize your prospects? We don't need this fight. This is a fight that should happen in 2 years. 3 years, when these women are in the top 10, in the top 5, we don't need it right now. But we are going to get it, and I'm not going to complain, Matt. Erin Blanchfield is one of the most interesting prospects coming out of the New York, New Jersey area that we've had in some time. She's such a great grappler. You know the pedigree of her wrestling, of her jiu-jitsu at Henzo's, of her striking that continues to advance. You want to see a great Erin Blanchfield fight. Look at the fight that she lost by split decision to Tracy Cortez. How big is Cortez? How good is Cortez with the grappling? Pretty good. Erin won that fight. I'll take it to my grave. But if you really want a good display...
Craig thinks the losing fighter in a close decision won. What a surprise.
You want a good display of her striking? Look at her fight against Victoria Leonardo, where she capitalizes on that head kick. She goes to the well. She gets the win. She looks amazing, Matt. Blanchfield with that lone blemish on her record. I don't even consider it a blemish. For Miranda Maverick... will they pump her fights that she won on the Phoenix?
They gotta stop.
The one-round fights that she had with Invicta in the tournament? They might. But if you look at the level of competition that she has on her record, even in the 5-on-in, Deanna Bennett, Pearl Gonzalez with Invicta, UFC caliber, she beats Liana Jojua by TKO, she brutalized her nose, Courtney Casey did that recently, she beats Jillian Robertson at Robertson's own game until the dying seconds of the third round where, yikes, and then against Macy Barber, a very, very close fight, she loses by split decision, but again, I hate to be the split decision contrarian am. Miranda Maverick won that fight.
What a surprise.
We all know it.
It was close. This is the problem. Miranda Maverick lost her ability to argue with the result of that fight because she didn't really separate herself that much from Macy Barber. And this is what I'm going to say. These three ladies could fight each other every single day, and they would all have a different outcome every single time. Like, Miranda Maverick, Macy Barber, and Erin Blanchfield all do have very similar games, and all are at very similar stages of their careers. It just really comes down to, how are they each going to develop on their own right? Because For Blanchfield, like you brought up, she's this phenomenal grappler. She's got this great wrestling and overall jiu-jitsu base, but she's been able to make these massive strides in her striking. And Blanchfield's ceiling is going to be dictated by how good her striking is able to get. Because let's say she is able to start putting big combinations together to at least back her opponents up against the cage. That's going to give her another weapon with her forward pressure that she doesn't already have. Like, I know it didn't really work out this way, but it was, my point was right. Where Clay Guida doesn't really pressure his opponents with his striking much anymore. It's a lot of that, I'm going to march you, I'm going to try to cut you off with my feet, then I'll wrestle you into the cage. For Blanchfield, that is sort of her game right now, but you can tell that she's starting to open it up, like you had said. The advancements in her striking are very noticeable. It's a very promising thing to see from such a young fighter. For Maverick, it's so interesting because she's such a hyped up prospect. She has a lot of promise, but I got to be honest, and maybe I'm the only one, I don't feel like she's progressed that much throughout her UFC career. I feel like we got a very good version of Miranda Maverick. No. My point is, I feel like Maverick came over as a very, very good version of herself. Like a college player who played for 4 years and then got drafted. Like, she showed up, was very good. I just don't know how much more she's improved since her initial UFC debut.
Let me fill you in. I mean, for Miranda Maverick over the time since she lost that fight against Macy Barber. And listen, MMA decisions, 22 media votes on this one. All of them. 29-28 Maverick. The judges in that fight, Sal D'Amato, Dave Hagen, both scored at 29-28 for Barber.
If it's a close fight and you lose the third round, I don't think you can complain that you lost a decision.
Chris Lee had it for Miranda Maverick. I hate to agree with Chris Lee, but on that one I will. But if you look at it for Maverick, she was a part of Andrea Lee's camp for her fight against Calvillo, or at least bits and pieces of it. She's also moved her training to Colorado. She's been training at Elevation with Raquel Pennington, JJ Aldrich. Last weekend's fight of the night, one half of it, Mallory Martin. For Maverick, though, you really like that because that's going to help her cardio training at high elevation. It's going to help with those wrestlers as well, getting ready for a fight against Blanchfield, who, by the way, is so slippery when it gets to the mat. Now, in the Guida comp, A, if it goes between round one and round two, is Blanchfield going to let out like an earth-shattering burp, do you think, like Clay Guida?
Probably not. And Clay Guida's hair might even be longer.
Does she have a brother that's going to slap her up before the fight?
I hope not. Like, I remember, do you remember Jason Perillo slapping Chris Cyborg?
Yeah.
Like, that's disturbing. You don't need to hit her that hard.
All right, well, we look at this fight, two uber prospects, both good in their own right. We talked about Blanchfield with the complete game, and we said the fact that Maverick is like one of those five-tool players out of college. But so far, to me, she's been like Kyle Pitts. I was sold a bill of goods. I'm supposed to get all these fantasy points. I take them near the top of the draft, and now I'm sitting here going, Kyle, you've had 3 good weeks, bud, but I'm sitting you for Dawson Knox of the Bills.
So, I can one-up you. I took Michael Porter Jr. with the 3rd pick in my fantasy draft this year, and he's out with back surgery. It gets worse, Craig.
All right, Matt, but when we focus on this one, we pick out ways to win, and we'll talk about it. The odds for this fight, Maverick opened a plus 135. She's a minus 146. Blanchfield open a minus 155. She's a plus 121. If we look at this card in terms of big movers and shakers, Maverick the biggest at a 49% clip. We look at the Tapology votes for this one. Not even
really
close. 596 total votes, 79% Maverick, 87% by decision. The 21% that have Blanchfield, 84% by decision. Matt, all of this is a surprise to me.
I think Erin Blanchfield's going to get it done. I do. The problem with Miranda Maverick is that I've seen her get taken down by much lesser wrestlers than what I believe Erin Blanchfield is. Julie Robertson is not a bad MMA fighter by any means, but she was able to control and at least take down Miranda Maverick on a couple of different occasions throughout their fight. And if Blanchfield's able to get a very similar position on her, I don't think she's going to give it up. I think she is the much bigger fighter and the much more physically dominant fighter too. And that has to be said about both these two women. I feel like strength is a big factor in both of their games, so we'll be really interesting to see who wins that first wrestling exchange between the two of them, but I do believe Erin Blanchfield is going to be able to get it done.
I've got Miranda Maverick in this fight, and I'll give you 2 reasons why. Love the well-roundedness. I think that if she concedes a bit of the second round, again, it happened in her last fight, a bit of the second round and the third round, she started to tire a little bit against Robertson, but again, they trained together for her last fight against Barber, so you love to see that. Training with Andrea Lee, that's only going to make you better. I think those advancements at elevation, and you don't like to look too much into IG, but here's what I'll say. She's almost on weight, and she's been in great shape getting ready for this one. I absolutely love to see it. I love the professionalism that it's taken in this camp to get to that place. I like Maverick in this fight, but man, This is a close one. I'd sit back with pot and popcorn and enjoy it because I'm right on the fence of this one. I gotta let that be known.
I don't think being able to wait 2 weeks before a fight's a good thing at all. I think
almost
it's I think it's really bad, though. Because either one of two things happen. Either A, you're not big enough for this division at all because everybody else is cutting weight. Or B, you decided to cut your weight too early and your cardio won't be there by the time of the fight. Like, you may have burnt up too much of your own fuel in your training camp. And that's what I'm worried about. That's a big point in boxing where, like, you want guys to be a certain weight every single day. Like, boxing trainers have it down to where I know what my athlete is going to weigh every day we train together because that's how regimented our training is. With Maverick, it's just, that's kind of a weird thing that I'm not a huge fan of. I like Blanchfield, though, mainly due to her wrestling and her grappling ability. If this fight is just contested on the feet, then Maverick's going to have a great opportunity to get it done, but I do think Blanchfield is the slightly more overpowering wrestler.
We're split on the pick. I've got Miranda Maverick, fear thee. Matt has cold-blooded Blanchfield. You let us know down below in the comments section who you have, because this fight features a couple of great prospects in this loaded now flyweight division. You're not going to want to miss it, as well as our big-time fights up at the top. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Big time fight coming up at middleweight this weekend. Andrea Muniz looking to stay perfect in the UFC. He's got a big time test in front of him in Roll Tide's own Eric Anders. And for ya boy, this is a guy who's had the highest of highs in the UFC, the lowest of lows, and in main events, Anders has had a weird run, and I want to go through it a little bit because sometimes he gets big wins over Darren Stewart. Sometimes fights are close against Darren Stewart, and then they're not. Sometimes he knocks out Tim Williams with the most disgusting soccer kick I've ever seen in my life. Sometimes he loses fights to Elias Theodorou. So really, it's been a weird mixed bag. And for Anders, I say in main events it's bad, but he had that weird short-notice call-up when he took on Thiago Santos. And it went so bad. He had that fight against Lyoto Machida that was, I mean, listen, did he win the fight? No. I don't know. We can agree or disagree till the cows come
home. Well, again.
But it just continues to further the point of, this guy's had a weird rant. Like, he's lost to Christoph Jocko and Khalil Roundtree in the UFC. And not just any Khalil, Bangkok Ready Khalil. So for Anders, it's odd. He's made the move over to Fight Ready in Arizona. And he's looked good his last two performances under Eddie Cha, under Santino DeFranco. He's a weird case because he's still somewhat young in his MMA career, but he tends to fight quite a bit. He's also not the youngest guy. He's 34, almost 35. For Andrea Muniz, I have to say this. I had no clue what I was getting when he came into the UFC. I thought he was going to be bad. I knew how good of a grappler he was, but all of his losses are primarily by knockout. His last loss was years ago against Azamat Mirzakhanov, which, listen, he was supposed to be in the UFC last weekend on short notice at heavyweight against Jared Vandera, so that would have been interesting. But for Muniz, nobody can submit him, right, Matt?
Muniz has one way to win this fight. Yes, he's a third-degree black belt in jiu-jitsu. Yes, he's great on the mat. I'm telling you this right now. It's not like Jacare is like a Rodolfo Vieira, where I'm worried that he's going to get tired and that there's a world out there where Jacare could get submitted. I'm telling you this right now. Jacare is not going to get submitted by Andrea Muniz. There is not a world, there is not any situation where Muniz outgrapples Jacare in this fight. I understand people are going to be selling your wolf tickets. They're going to say, hey, if anyone can do it, it's Muniz.
You may have said that you knew how good his grappling was. I obviously didn't, because I didn't think there was a single world out there where Andrea Muniz would be able to submit Jacare. Now, was it a beautiful transition to the armbar? Yeah, it was. Did he break Jacare's arm? Yeah, he did, resulting in a submission. So I was proven wrong. But I will say, I've never been happier to be wrong on this channel in my whole life. Because when someone like that gets submitted of Jacare's caliber, it proves that the person who did the submitting must also be an absolute monster in their own right. And for Muniz, he does have that 10 out of 10. That's probably not even doing it justice. Just how good his jiu-jitsu is. If you are on the mat with Andrea Muniz, you are in danger of getting submitted. But this is one of those weird fights where, let's say we stack up all of both guys' skills just next to each other. I don't even think, they don't even come close. I think Andrea Muniz is by far the more skilled mixed martial artist between these two guys. I think his technique on the feet is better. I don't think he has more power or more speed, but I do think technically he is the much better fighter in a lot of areas. What I will say, though, is that he's kind of slow at reacting to shots coming his way. Eric Anders is very, very fast for the size of him, and Anders, I hate just using he's a really good athlete, but it really does sort of paint the picture when you talk about Eric Anders. He's just a big guy who's way faster than he should be for the size of him. And he's got this weird striking style where He can sometimes be in that open karate stance, but he likes to crash forward with his boxing. It is very unique, and it's very odd, because, listen, do I think Anders can grapple with Muniz for even 1 minute in this fight? I don't. Do I think Muniz can stand with Anders for a little bit? Yeah, I do, but if Muniz can't get the takedown, I'm going to be really worried about him in this matchup. And it's not like Eric Anders has lights out takedown defense or anything like that. But when you're as strong and you're as fast as a guy like Anders is, you're going to be able to defend some of those sloppier takedowns coming from the other side of the cage. So this fight, more than any other, is just going to come down to how does Muniz transition from his striking into his takedown attempts?
76% takedown defense from Eric Anders in the UFC. And if you focus on the guys that he's fought, well, who's taking Eric Anders down? Let's go through it. Thiago Santos took him down once. Anders took Santos down 6 times. Who else? Marcus Perez took him down twice. But that's pretty much it. Like, that's it. And he's fought some good fighters in the UFC. For Muniz, his takedown average and offense, 40%, 3.12 per fight. You like to see that. So it really does come down to the key Excalibur-type strength that Andrea Muniz possesses to the well-roundedness of Eric Anders, and he is very well-rounded. Now, does he fight an MMA like a football player?
A little bit.
A refined amount. I mean, let's take some football players that are in MMA and talk about how they capitalize on their athleticism. Matt Mitrione.
Greg Hardy. Brenton Schaus.
That was going to be mine. Like, there's some of these guys that, yeah, they already had those intangibles. They just had to turn it up a little bit, gain a little bit of fight IQ, and knock out Mirko Krokop. For Eric Anders, he's one of those guys that's done that and then cranked the dial off. He's probably one of those premier athletes and versions of, I used to be this, now I'm this. Like Volkanovski, I was a thick boy rugby player, now I'm the best featherweight at this current juncture. I'm not ready to capitalize and crown him the best. I still think Jose Aldo's best featherweight.
Eric Anders is the type of guy who, like, has probably never played basketball before, just shows up to a YMCA and can dunk without shoes on.
Like Jimmy Graham.
Yeah, like, it doesn't really matter what the sport is. You just sort of tell him what the rules are, and he'll be able to pick it up as he goes. Now, with MMA, he is much more refined than what I just laid out, but I still don't look at him as this massive technician on the feet or with his wrestling or with his grappling. I feel like he's a very physically dominant fighter, but when his physical gifts are at least on point with his opponent, that's what we normally see his opponent take over. Like, for instance, I would say Eric Anders is a much better athlete than the majority of the opponents he's fought. But against Thiago Santos, who I would say, especially at the time, good ACLs intact, what is like as good of an athlete as we've ever seen in MMA, you can see that, okay, athleticism can keep you on point with some of the strikes, land it back and forth, but when Santos was able to go deeper into his bag, initiate the leg kicks, use elbows, that's when Eric Anders does start to fall behind in fights. And even the Machida fight, like, Machida was older in his career, and it was a close fight, but still, when Machida was using his footwork to almost set up Eric Anders and walk him into his shots, that's when he was having a lot of success. So I think with Anders, if you can outthink him in the cage, it does give you an opportunity to win. And with Muniz, that's interesting, because Muniz isn't really a thinker in the cage. He's much more of a, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to get your back, and I'm going to try to choke you out. So although this fight seems like a bit of a mismatch, I know the odds don't suggest that, I think this is going to be a great fight.
I mean, the best fight to go back and watch for Muniz, if you like him in this one, the Bartosz-Fabinski fight. I remember doing the preview going, all Bartosz does is go for double legs and leave his head to the side. If Muniz just grabs it, he's going to submit him, but I'm taking Bartosz anyway, and then look what happens. So, Matt, the odds for this one, Eric Anders is the underdog. I threw my notes out, so he's a +105 at open. Now he's a +119 for Muniz. Open, a -125. He's a -144. Topology votes, surprise to us, they are to you. Yeah, I mean, 582 total votes, 87% Muniz, 75% by submission. For 13% that have Anders, 48% by knockout, 34% by decision. Matt, we've given equal opportunity to both guys, but what's the pick here?
Okay, remember on last weekend's card, I said, hey, I like Jimmy Crute, but I've got a really weird feeling about this fight. And if Jamahal Hill wins by knockout, wouldn't be surprised. Andrea Muniz should win this fight. Again, when we talk about skills and who is the more skilled mixed martial artist, without question it is Andrea Muniz. But there is something to be said for athleticism, and that is making me just sit on the fence a little bit, although my official pick will be Muniz. Will I be surprised if Anders goes out there, defends a few early takedowns, gets Muniz tired, knocks him out with a big shot? Not at all, because I do feel like we're seeing a bit of an evolution in the game of Anders, especially with his last two fights against Aaron Stewart, but I think the pick is going to be Muniz.
I like Muniz in this fight for the sole fact that Anders is very good with the stand-up, and he's progressed a lot since he's joined Fight Ready.
But he will still implement the takedown. And when you're messing around with that up against the cage or on the mat, Muniz is not that guy. So we'll see how Anders adjusts here. I can't wait to see these guys face off. This is a great one for question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims. We also have a fight companion this weekend that you're not going to want to miss for the main card with those two title fights. Right now, as it stands early in the week, both of us going with Andrea Muniz, but you could cut this one with a knife. It's razor thin. Absolutely love the fights. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it. Absolute banger coming up this weekend at middleweight. We have the former M1 global champion Bruno Blindado Silva taking on a guy whose nickname almost seems sacrilegious in the Beverly Hills Ninja, Jordan Wright, a guy who trains under Anthony Hardonk and Vladimir Matyushenko. That's gonna work out well for him in a fight against Silva, because if this fight were a song, it would be like the one off of Cheap Trick's Dream Police. You know it as writing on the wall. You know why, Matt? Because somebody's getting knocked the fuck out in this fight, and I absolutely love it. My guy, Bruno Silva, I've been high on for years, since he was fighting the Artem Frolovs of the world over with M1. Since we were in that era of conversation, you look at the five on end for him, it's Shlemenko, it's Frolov, it was supposed to be Riggs, maybe, and Riggs fought Frolov, and everything gels in my mind with M1 Global. They were a fun promotion. Sure. But when I focus on this fight, Bruno Silva won his last fight by knockout, kicked old Aldierte Sanchez, Andrew Sanchez, out of the UFC by all intents and purposes. But Matt, it was like Aaron Rodgers in 2015. He threw that Hail Mary up, and thank goodness they caught it in the end zone.
With Bruno Silva, he's always going to have that, like, oh, you have eye-catching talent? Well, we're waiting for you to lose in a really, really bad way. And he is going to be one of those fighters who, when he does lose, is going to be that Rodolfo Vieira kind of loss, where it's like, wow, was Bruno ever really that good? Now, I don't think you can overcorrect it all that much if he does lose, but he does have a weakness in his game. For as good as his power is, as great as his boxing is, he has been susceptible to getting taken down throughout his career. And really, that's the only question mark in this fight. I gotta be honest. If I wanted to put a song to this fight, it would be Another One Bites the Dust, because I don't think Jordan Wright has that great of an opportunity in this one, if I'm just being very honest. Because this is how I look at this fight. Can Jordan Wright take down Bruno Silva? Of course he can. He's not a terrible wrestler by any means. He's a decent one, I'd say. But is that really a part of his game plan? No. And that's what I always go back to. Like, Jose Aldo, they brought it up last night, where it's, hey, you don't really leg kick that much anymore because you really just train your boxing a lot. And if you're not training it, you're probably not using it in the cage. With Jordan Wright, he can wrestle, but he's not a natural wrestler. So I don't think he's just going to go out there and start blasting double legs against Bruno Silva early. And honestly, I think that's his best way to win.
I've got a weird question in this one, because if you combine it, 30 of their 33 combined wins are by knockout.
That's wild.
Which is insane. And 6 of their 7 losses are by finish. Yeah. So you hate to see that one. And realistically, I mean, Silva has 18 knockout wins to his credit. And I should say 30 of 33 wins are by finish, because actually for Wright, more of his wins are by submission than they are by knockout. For Silva, all of his wins by finish are by knockout. He's got 3 decision wins. So
they're scary knockouts.
When I look at this fight though, for Jordan Wright, why do MMA fans hate him so much? Because he's a little bit cocky. I don't like the nickname, but overall, in his fights, he's a very, very exciting striker and flashy at that, too.
Exactly, and he gets into what we love, 50-50 exchanges, but you don't want to get into 50-50 exchanges with a guy like Bruno Silva. Now, I'm not as hot and heavy. Like, you're the conductor of the Bruno Silva hype train. I'm further back in the caboose. I'm making my way up to, like, the drink cart, but I just think eventually Silva's going to fight somebody who is a really good wrestler. I don't know who that is in this division, but it's going to look bad when it does look really bad. The problem, though, is that Jordan Wright defends punches like Luke Rockhold. He puts his chin up in the air,
like, and
he
is a very tall guy.
I would say it's different, because with Luke Rockhold and with Jordan Wright, the reason their defense is this way is because they're so tall. When you're the tall guy, and this matters too, because this goes back to your training. When you're the taller guy all the time, you can always avoid shots by just leaning back, especially when you're training with people who are smaller than you. And it's a really nasty habit to get into. But when you're getting away with it in training and you're not getting clipped, in your mind, you're like, hey, this is really good and really sound defense. But we saw it against Joaquin Buckley. When you just move backwards to defend punches, anybody with any striking IQ is just going to use their feet to follow yours. Unless you're moving backwards on an angle, We're going to talk about that in the main event with Poirier and Charles Oliveira, like L-stepping right and left. Jordan Wright doesn't do that. He just backs straight up. And if Bruno Silva decides, I'm just going to start throwing in combinations while I move forward, it's going to end very poorly for the Beverly Hills Ninja.
The best part of the episode when Matt talks about going to a drink cart, the last time we were on a train going to the drink cart, we would have been, I don't know, 12? I would have been about 12. Matt would have been 7 or 8. And we get up to the drink cart, I've got the money, and Matt goes,
I want a pop, and they didn't know what
No, he goes, I'll have an orange pop. We're in New England, to set the scene, going from Portland, Maine to Boston, and the guy goes, what? And Matt goes, I'll have an orange pop, and the guy goes, you want a soda? So Matt, having a hard time with the drink cart, that unlocked a memory.
That happened when I was younger, okay?
Call it a soda when you're in certain parts of the state.
Sorry, 7-year-old Matt didn't understand the difference.
Well, to not 7-year-old Matt, who recently celebrated a birthday, congrats. Bruno Silva opened a -350, still about there for Jordan Wright. He is a +285 underdog. We look at the votes on Tapology. They're not close. 600 of them. 83% of the 89% of the fans have Silva to win by knockout. 9% have him to win by decision. 3% by submission. For the 11% of the fans that have Right to win, 59% have him to win by knockout. Matt, again, when 30 of 33 combined wins are by finish, you're probably going to get a finish in this one, and it's probably going to be a number that's not -370. I would go with that because Bruno Silva can get finished. I've seen it before. Now, it's been by submission. It hasn't been by knockout. But I would still go with that over picking fighter A or fighter B. Having said that, got to go with Bruno Silva here.
I think I've said like 6 times in this video already that I think Silva's going to win by knockout. So yeah, I think Silva's probably going to win by knockout.
Both of us going for an orange pop after this one, not a soda. Up yours, New England? Not really. Love you. But both of us going with Bruno Silva in this one. And a giant fight card coming up this weekend. 2 big title fights. Amanda Nunes taking on Juliana Pena. And in your main event, Charles Oliveira, Dustin Poirier. You're not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Absolute banger in the UFC's heavyweight division coming up this weekend. We have a giant fall from grace for a guy who headlined his last 2 fights in Augusto Sakai, taking on Bam Bam Tied to Ivasa, a guy who knocked out Greg Hardy in one of the most hellacious KOs we've seen in recent memory. Matt, I love the fight because for Augusto Sakai, what's the thing that got him to the dance? Was it a split decision loss to Czech Congo over with Bellator?
Maybe.
Not necessarily, but that was his last loss coming into the UFC. That was his only loss on his pro record. And then you look at it, in his last 2 fights, he loses to Alistair Overeem, where he gets out-volumed and taken down.
I don't think he looked that bad early on.
Didn't necessarily think I was going to get that type of performance out of Mr. Augusto Sakai. And then in his last fight, well, Jairzinho finally decided, I'm going to do what got me to the dance, and I'm going to knock him out in the first round. So for Sakai, he goes from headlining his last 2 fights, and they weren't that long ago, really. Like, you might think about it, Wolverine's been away for a long time. That main event was only 1 year and 2 months ago, and then his fight against Jairzinho was about 6 months ago. So he's healed up. He's back in here against Tuivasa, who had his own struggles. He had that 3-fight losing streak. He lost to JDS, Blagoy, and Sergey Spivak. But then you look at the wins. He knocks out Stefan Struve once in the fight and once after the fight. He knocks out Harry Hunsucker, who was in on short notice. And then he knocks out Greg Hardy. And all's not lost with old Tai Tuivasa, right?
He did get hurt, though, right before he knocked out Greg Hardy, and that's a little bit concerning. And I think that's something that we all kind of forget about, but it was a pretty big point in that fight. The reason Tai Tuivasa knocked out Greg Hardy was that Hardy hits him with a right hand, hurts Tuivasa, then gets excited and opens himself up and gets hit with a big knockout shot. But I do worry about Tuivasa's just not his ability to take a shot. I shouldn't say that. I worry about his striking defense for being such a highly touted striker and for being such a natural striker, because we don't normally see guys who have a Muay Thai background or a boxing background show up to the UFC and then just be very hittable on the feet. But that really has been the story for Tai Tuivasa. I always go back to the Blagoy Ivanov fight, because I know we probably talk about Blagoy more than we should, but
the
like,
guy got stabbed in the heart,
he
was
did.
In a coma for 2 months,
and hey,
then continued his career. He beat Fedor Emelianenko and Sambo.
Exactly.
Blagoy.
If you think that's not hard to do, you don't know the combo Sambats. Or I don't even know. Okay. This is the thing about Augusto Sakai. He is a very, very big heavyweight, but he doesn't really fight like one. And that's why I was really excited when he first came over to the UFC, because I know he's not like a 265 heavyweight, but frame-wise, he's huge. He lumbers forward, he has good leg kicks. He seemed to be a more complete heavyweight than you normally see just make their UFC debut. And yes, I understand, he's not just some guy off the street. Like, he had a good level of competition coming in, but I had pretty high hopes for Augusto Sakai. The only thing I'll zag, though, with what you had said was, I thought he looked okay against Overeem until Overeem did start going for the takedown. I think the big key in this fight, and what both fighters have to know, is that their opponent has zero game off of their back. Like, if you're Augusto Sakai and you get one takedown, you're going to destroy Tai Tuivasa. Probably knock him out with ground and pound in the first round, it won't be close. And I know takedowns aren't really part of Tuivasa's game, but if you're Tuivasa, you're probably telling yourself, okay, if I hit him and drop him one time, he also has nothing off of his back, so I'll be more... I guess I'll be more tempted to jump into his guard and go for the finish on the ground. Because with Tuivasa, it's okay. I drop my opponent, then I kind of have to wait for them to get back up because I'm so hesitant with my own grappling. I don't think he's going to have that same limitation in this fight.
Matt, really looking at a Sears Christmas wish book. And in that book, Matt, you will find for $0 the fact that Tai Tuivasa has not gotten a single takedown in his UFC career. And Augusto Sakai averages 0.14 takedowns per 15 minutes.
Okay, if you were Sakai's coach, you're probably telling him, like, hey, shoot one takedown and we win this fight.
Yeah, if you want to take it for Sakai, you're going to look at the fight that Sergei Spivak had against Tai Tuivasa. And if you want it for Tuivasa, go in there like Rosenstreich. Blitz him quick and knock him out. Easier said than done. You want a good win for Sakai? You go look at his fight against Marcin Tybura. He knocked him out right around the one-minute mark. You want a good win for Tuivasa? I don't know, Hunsucker, Struve, Greg Hardy, like, what do you want out of me? So when I look at this fight, Matt, I find that it's lined properly, although I think it kind of shades Sakai and his experience a little bit. This line's at par. So listen, you can flip your coin. It's a free vote. It's an interesting one there. We look at the votes on Tapology. 595 wow. Total votes, 79% Tuivasa, 88% by knockout for the 21% that have Sakai, 63% by decision. I think that Augusto Sakai has a more well-rounded base in striking than Tai Tuivasa. Why do I say that? Head, body, kicks, everything that he brings together. His length, his distance management, everything is there. His chin wasn't there his last fight, and against Overeem, his takedown defense wasn't there. Tuivasa is not going for takedowns. Matt wants them, but it won't happen. Exactly. So Tuivasa is out there to strike. He's out there to bang. He's out there to put on a great performance. I can't wait to hear the walkout song. Hopefully it doesn't go to commercial and we see some Home Hardware ad on TSN. But Matt, in this one, I have Brazil Sakai ever so slightly. But when you have heavyweights like this at even money, I sit there, I eat my popcorn, I enjoy it.
This is the most 50-50 fight on the card because whoever lands the first clean shot is probably going to win. It's as easy as that. If Sakai hits Tuivasa with like a clean right hand, wobbles him, he's going to finish him pretty much right after. And the same thing has to be said for Tuivasa against Sakai. I agree with you though. I do think Sakai has the slightly more well-rounded form of striking. He does invest in the leg kick. He does have decent volume. Again, I remember watching the Overeem Sakai fight thinking Sakai got destroyed, but I rewatched that fight this week and it was more competitive than I had originally thought it was, and I do think that you can take some positives out of that matchup. I liked his volume, I liked his striking on the outside in that matchup, but the problem with Sakai always will be takedown defense, and the same thing has to be said for Tuivasa. So I think this is going to be a really good fight, but I don't think we're going to learn a lot about either one of these fighters.
Matt, the fans down below, if they just watch this pick, they're going to be disappointed, both of us going with Augusto Sakai. But if you watch the video, you know there's a great opportunity for both of these guys in this one. It's a free vote. You let us know down below who you have in this fight between the Australian and the Brazilian. We have some big-time fights on our main card. And even still to come, Josh Emmett, Dan Ige. My favorite fight of the weekend. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend at Bantamweight. We have a guy who's 5-on-in spans almost 6 years in the Dominator Dominic Cruz, arguably the best Bantamweight of all time. He's going to be taking on the Young Punisher at 35 years old. You got to scrap the nickname. Pedro Munhoz, a guy who doesn't know a boring fight. And listen, how many Pedro Munhoz fights do you go, gee, I wish that one didn't happen. I wish I kind of walked away, went to the corner store for that one. You don't, because they're all great. And I'm not just planning that one in your mind. Sometimes for Pedro Munhoz, he comes to our neck of the wood, Atlanta, Canada. and he gets in trouble with USADA. But other than that,
he also beats Brian Caraway, though.
There's that, too. So if you look at the 5-on-in for Pedro Munhoz, he knocks out Cody Garbrandt, something Dominic Cruz couldn't do. He loses to Aljamain Sterling by decision. Loses to Frank Yeager by split decision. Pedro won that fight. He beats a big-time Jimmy Rivera, and then he loses to Jose Aldo's last time out. But for Pedro, there's two things that I absolutely love. Really, there's three. Wonderful volume, especially in three-round fights. Great footwork, and he's got that power that can put guys' lights out. And if you want the example, it's that Garbrandt fight, man. They threw leather.
They did. And that was one of the craziest, like, oh, you want to just trade overhand right fights you'll ever see in your life. I agree with the assessment, but I have to disagree with the first point you made. I don't know if he still has great volume, because in the Jose Aldo fight, that was the first time we saw Munhoz almost question himself throwing combinations. It wasn't the fact that he was okay just moving forward, throwing shots. He was kind of hesitant in that matchup.
But look what happened to Rob Font. No, Jose Aldo does that to people.
I understand, but Pedro Munhoz did not look like himself in that fight at all. He didn't throw with volume. He didn't lead the dance. Pedro Munhoz always leads the dance, even against Frank Yeager. He may have lost that fight, but he was the one moving forward. Against Aldo, that was the first fight in the UFC Pedro Munhoz did not move forward on. So I think that's a pretty big point. That's why I bring it up.
Cruz can do that to a guy.
Cruz cannot fight like Jose Aldo at all.
He can make you confused and make you miss.
The difference, though, is that when Munhoz was fighting Aldo, Aldo was very defensively sound. So what he would do was he would absorb what Munhoz was throwing and then answer with his own strikes. What Dominic Cruz does is he's going to force you to miss and then try to lunge in. The difference is Cruz has no knockout power at all, and Jose Aldo has a ton of power at this division. That's why this fight's very weird, because Dominic Cruz against Casey Kenney showed that he's not the same championship caliber fighter anymore. At least I don't think he did. Like, he beat Kenney, but he barely beat him. And he beat Kenney because Kenney got tired as that fight continued. It was less that Dominic Cruz went out there and took the fight from Kenney. It was more that Kenney was a lesser version of himself later on because he was missing so much. And that's what I really do think this fight comes down to. If Cruz can make Munhoz miss in the first round, I think he's probably going to be able to do it in the second and third and pitter-patter his way to a decision win. If Munhoz is able to land those leg kicks early on, though, I think they're going to be able to slow down a lot of the movement of Cruz. And the weird thing with Dominic Cruz is that he gets brought up in this conversation a lot of, who are the best MMA wrestlers? Who are the best MMA wrestlers? I think it is fair to say that Dominic Cruz is one of the better MMA wrestlers of all time. But does Dominic Cruz ever shoot offensive takedowns? Ever? It's been a while, and it hasn't really been a part of his game for a minute now. So I'm very curious to see, if he is having trouble on the feet, do you think he'll feel comfortable enough taking down a guy like Munhoz, who we know is so dangerous on the mat?
No, and this is the one point that I really have on Dominic Cruz that I want to hammer home. Even look at the fight against Henry Cejudo, and then since then, as the example, because again, before Cejudo, there was a big layoff, there were the injuries. I mean, again, I don't consider this guy as the best bantamweight of all time for just nothing, for just laughs, clicks, and fun. Like, he really has had a wild run, WEC to UFC. It's just like me saying that Jose Aldo is my greatest featherweight of all time. It was such a long run against so many people and so much dominance, like Anderson Silva at 185. But when I look at this fight, Matt, for Cruz, he starts his first rounds out like he always did. It's a lot of figure eight movement, a lot of side to side, a lot of herky jerky top movement. It's still there. But in the second round, it's not. And it will at the start of the second. Then it goes away a little bit. And then in the third round, we're standing and we're trading. Against Casey Kenney, Kenny was so tired that it worked very well. Against Munhoz, though, when you start to lose that speed in the second and third round, that's when he can take over. However, Cruz is such a technician that he can kind of do certain things.
I hate to disagree with this, too, but I think Cruz is some of the best cardio ever. I really, like, he's only fought five-round fights for the majority of
his
career.
Watch his footwork in the second and
third. I know, but he always huffs and puffs. Like, this has always been Dominic Cruz. They're going to say this about Poirier, too, and this is like a Joe Roganism. Dominic Cruz huffs and puffs from the first second of the fight on, and people say, oh, look how tired he looks. Look at his chest right now. It's just how he moves. It's how he resets. He's often talked about this, where he likes to back up, he does his figure eight, and he does the deep breath as a reset. It's like an L step for him. It's just another way for him to get back into his sequences. The thing about Cruz that I do worry about, it's more about the leg kicks than anything. I think that's what slows him down. I don't think his cardio is bad by any means. I just think if you're an opponent and you're very dedicated to the leg kick, that will slow down his movement. TJ Dillashaw is able to do that against him. I don't think Dominic Cruz is ever getting tired, though, just because of his own output.
Yeah, and it's a different point I'm trying to make, so I just want to capitalize on it, because Cruz in that fight against Casey Kenney, first round, 26 strikes, second round, 36 strikes, third round, 53? Like, he turned it up. But that's the thing. Cruz, he relies on his movement in the first round, figure eights, whatever. Just watch his feet in the second and third round because he changes his style up just a little bit. He doesn't move his feet as much. He doesn't do that as much. He changes it up, and then he turns up the pressure in his offense.
When his opponent's leg kick, he does.
Different point that I have. But, Matt, when we look at this one, the odds are at par. They open at par. They're still at par right now. Young Punisher's got a big opportunity to win one over a former champ, and it has to be said, does Cody Garbrandt side-eye these guys when he's walking through the casino?
I doubt they're striking up conversations.
Yeah, that much is true. We look at the Tapology votes for this one. 740 total votes, 71% with Cruz, and 91% have him to win by decision. For the 29% that have Munoz, 75% have him to win by decision. I also think, like the fans, that this one is going to go by decision. I'll bring up the prop while I hand it on over to you, Matt, because, listen, decision makers waiting to happen. I'd say maybe Munoz has a better opportunity to get a finish, but it's hard to finish Cruz. I mean, Keith Peterson sometimes ends fights and sometimes he doesn't, so that's neither here nor there. What's the pick on this one?
I think Munoz is closer to his prime than Dominic Cruz is, but I still think Cruz stylistically is probably going to be able to get the win on this, and this is why I say that. Pedro is not a fast striker at all. He has very good power, but his strikes are coming at you so slow on the feet. He puts a lot behind them, especially with his punches. And for Cruz, who has such great footwork and such great head movement, he can do that against guys like TJ Dillashaw, who are some of the fastest guys in this division. I think he's going to make Munoz miss a lot, especially early on in this fight. And for as good as Munoz's leg kicks are, I think speed, again, is going to be a big factor. I think Cruz is going to be able to get his legs out of the way, at least early on, and probably be able to win a decision. This is what I'm going to say, though. Even if Dominic Cruz wins this fight, I don't think he's ever going to get back into that, like, top three championship-type contender. Like, I think maybe he can fight Jose Aldo as sort of a one-off Legends fight, sort of a throwback to the WEC days. But personally, I think he sort of showed that in the Kenny fight, that the injuries have taken a bit of a toll on him, and that he is no longer kind of prime Dominic Cruz.
I think Cruz can win this fight as well. And I think in the first round, if he can make a miss, like you said, really tire out Munoz, really move away from some of those leg kicks, stun on him a little bit, and then start to accumulate the fight as the rounds go on, really start to accumulate the volume, that can win it for him. You look at the fight that Munoz had against Jimmy Rivera, what worked so well for him in that one?
It was the leg kicks and the forward pressure.
Exactly. So it's one of those ones where Cruz can draw from all of the fights that Munoz has had in the UFC, and if Munoz goes for a takedown, I mean, my eyes would shoot out of my head. I would love to see it.
Because the grappling between these two guys would be really fun. And this is why I say, I don't think Cruz is going to shoot for a takedown unless he has to. But I do think he can grapple a little bit with Pedro Munoz. I don't think it's one of those cases where, oh, the second Munoz is on the mat with you, you've got to watch out for submission. Cruz can scramble very well, so I think this could be a phenomenal fight, but the pick is the Dominator.
Absolutely love this one. Both of us going with a former champion in Dominic Cruz to get the win. You let us know down below who you have in the comments section. This one at par early on in the week, and I can't wait for it. Up at the top, two title fights. Amanda Nunes defending against Juliana Pena. Charles Oliveira in his first title defense against Dustin Poirier. Should be amazing, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
As always, one half your host and duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at CraigAllenFNP. With me to my left, to your right, Matt Allen. You can find him on the respective socials. We make it really easy at MattAllenFNP. I'm going to start this video off for you and everybody out there because I want to hear from them down below in the comments section. A healthy Josh Emmett, would he have fought for the title already?
That's a really hard question to answer. It's hard to say he couldn't. Like, Josh Emmett, I would say he's probably the most powerful athlete in this division, at least punching power-wise. So, no matter what, he's always got that sort of X factor of, hey, I can finish the fight no matter what. But probably, honestly, like, that's the kind of trajectory that Josh Emmett was on.
So, for Emmett, he fights Jeremy Stephens years ago. And in that fight, he is all sorts of messed up with his orbital broken, so on and so forth. We had an interview with him on the channel from 2018 where he was getting ready for an ACB grappling tournament, or just after that, sorry. And he still wasn't really medically clear to fight in MMA, but grappling was cool. They flew him over to Russia. They paid him a ton of money, and that happened. And then it just took a long time to get him back in. So if you look at the 5-on-in for Josh Emmett, and the reason why I start the video that way, he beat Ricardo Lamas 4 years ago. He loses to Jeremy Stephens 3 months after that. He fights Michael Johnson, knocks him out. He fights Mirsad Bektic, knocks him out. And then he fights Shane Burgos and beats him by decision. Now, the reason why everything's been stalled out. He had the awful eye injuries, the concussion issues from that Jeremy Stephens fight that kept him out for a really long time. He fights Shane Burgos, and in that fight, he gets hurt. Matt, how bad does he get hurt? He gets hurt very bad.
Like Derrick Rose in 2011.
Complete ACL tear, partial MCL tear, and a sprain. He had a Baker's cyst rupture. He had a focal impact fracture of the femur. He had cartilage defect on the tibia. This all from MMA fighting. I'll throw the graphic up there now. Okay, so that was in the Shane Burgos fight, and that fight was a year and 5 months ago. So then back in this spring, there were articles like, hey, here's Josh Emmett's road to recovery. He'll be back. But why didn't he come back in the spring or the summer? I'll tell you why. Because he had a delay due to complications in recovery from the patella injury. He also fractured his patella bone. Matt, Josh Emmett's had injury woes, and he is 36, almost 37 years old in this featherweight division, taking on a spry young wrestler and striker in 50K Dan Ige. Matt, this is NAIA wrestling of Josh Emmett against the D3 wrestling of Dan Ige. But really, when it comes down to it, these guys are very well-rounded, and they have some fun styles.
Julian Lane would be proud of this fight, because these boys are coming to bang. And I don't really think we're going to see a lot of either guys wrestling in this matchup, although both guys can wrestle, and they are very good at it. When I think about Dan Ige, and especially his place in the top 15, I look at him as probably the most well-rounded guy in the top 15. He uses his wrestling, he uses his volume, he uses his power.
I think Volkanovski is.
Well, no, okay, other than the champion, of course. But when you look at Dan Ige, he's not really great at any one thing. He's just very, very good at everything. And maybe that's a little disrespectful to his boxing, because he is a very good boxer. It just, when you look at him against, like, Calvin Kattar, the Korean Zombie, you see that there are some limitations to even what he is very good at. That's why this fight against Emmett is going to be really interesting, because Calvin Kattar and the Korean Zombie are not only very good boxers, they are very high-volume boxers with the way that they do fight. Whereas Josh Emmett, yes, he also relies on his boxing, but he's really just looking to set up that one big shot. And it's not just like, oh, I'm just saying this because he's done it. Like, that's his whole style. He is fine with losing two rounds just to knock you out in the third.
Like against Michael Johnson.
Exactly. Now, you might look at that performance two different ways, and I would have to agree with you on both of them. You could say, hey, it's not very good that Josh Emmett got outstruck for about 12 minutes against Michael Johnson, and I would agree with you on that. But the great thing about Emmett is that he always has that nuclear power, whereas, hey, if you slip up for 1 second, I can end this fight. And it's really interesting, because I don't know what version of Emmett we're going to get in the cage, but I will say that I worry about him slightly less with injuries, and I only say this because he fought with those injuries against Shane Burgos. Like, people make a big deal that Klay Thompson hit two free throws after he tore his ACL. Don't get me wrong, that's really, really cool. Josh Emmett fought Shane Burgos for 10 more minutes on a torn ACL and dropped him and got stronger as the fight went on.
Like, that was a fight of the year contender.
Exactly. And he did things, and he just dug to a level that not many people will ever have to dig to. That was like the Michael Jordan flu game. It really was, because I know I had Burgos. I don't remember your pick on that one, but I really thought Shane Burgos was going to be able to go in there and look really good. And when Emmett hurt his leg in the first round, I thought Emmett was a sitting duck. But what he was able to prove was that he's a good defensive boxer, because he can wait for his opponent to come to him, and when he counters with power, there's not a guy in this division who can eat his shots.
If you look at it for Josh Emmett, he has 10 knockdowns in his UFC career, 4 of them against Felipe Arantes. Matt, where's Felipe these days?
Yikes! BKFC.
He's got a fight of the night, he's got performance of the night against Bektic, he had a fight of the year contender against Shane Burgos. It's just that Zhang Weili fought Ioana that year, so there was that. There were other good fights as well. But yeah, I mean, I look at this one for Dan Ige. He's got performance of the night bonuses against Danny Henry and Gavin Tucker. And in that Tucker fight, man, wow.
Right down the middle.
Where's the power from Dan Ige? I mean, he used it in that one. So a giant win from there. I look at the odds for this one. Emmett open to minus 200 favorite. He's minus 187 right now. Ige open a plus 170 favorite. He's a plus 155 as it stands. And as you said, Emmett had all the injuries out of that Jeremy Stephens fight, and then he comes back and he's won his last three, and he's looked good. A little slow at the start against Johnson, start into like the later half until he finishes it. Had a good fight against Bektic where he gets the win, and then his last time out, a giant win over Shane Burgos. But again, tons of injuries. Now, he kind of attributed it to the adrenaline in the fight. Obviously, it hurt, but it didn't hurt that bad. But my goodness, man, I look at those injuries. And yes, it's been a long layoff, but then there's the complications after the fact. And I look at Dan Ige, this guy is spry as they come. So I want to look at the fan vote here on Topology. 676 total votes, 72% Emmett, 64% by decision, 30% by knockout. For the 28% that have Ige, 66 by decision, and 22% by knockout. What are you saying in this one? Because really, I think it's a well-matched fight. It's just one guy has such a decided power advantage.
That's the thing. These guys are very equal. Like, they match up very equally, but Emmett's by far the more powerful guy. And if anybody tells you otherwise, quit listening to their opinion in MMA. This is what I will say about Dane Ige, though. It's not just the injuries. He is the slightly more active fighter, but that might come back to bite him in this fight because Emmett's so good at, okay, we're in the pocket, we're in the pocket. I'm going to just engage you, cover up, cover up, cover up. And the second you're done throwing your shots, if your hands aren't up and if you're not exiting that pocket in an intelligent manner, Josh Emmett's going to land something on you that you're not going to see coming, and it's going to put you out. I don't care who you are. Like, Josh Emmett's probably the only guy in the division that I think could knock out Max Holloway. Like, probably do it with one shot. That's the type of fight-ending power I think Emmett has. With all the injuries, I'm a little bit concerned. But again, it's not just the pain in the Burgos fight. He fought him on a knee that wasn't there. Like, there were no ligaments still attached. There was nothing still working in his knee. But he was still able to find the balance, just like with the bones, I guess, in his leg, and beat Shane Burgos. Like, that's how good of a fighter Emmett is. This pick's really hard because I can see Ige landing a clean shot down the middle, hurting Emmett, and then just sort of, not knocking him out, but just sort of being ahead the whole entire fight. You know, getting off to a good start and just sort of getting so much volume against him that Emmett's never able to come back. But it's so hard to pick against Josh Emmett and his power. I guess I'll pick the underdog in Dane Ige, but this fight to me is as close as any on the card.
I get Dane Ige too, and here's why. Thiago Santos had a crap ton of power before he fought John Jones. He injures his knee.
He's coming back.
He beat Johnny Walker, and he didn't look too bad in that one, but he hasn't looked like the same fighter that he was when he was on that run. He was older in his career. His power was his thing and his movement, and that's what it is for Josh Emmett now.
I'll say Cub Swanson, though, did prove us wrong with that.
It hurts my heart not to pick Josh Emmett because, listen, I can see him going out there and flooring Dane Ige, and I'd be happy to be wrong, and I'd be happy that somebody puts a compilation on Instagram like Billy Q did and makes fun of me. I'm absolutely fine with that. The pitter-patter of Dane Ige, whose career numbers actually don't meet the threshold of Emmett's, you know, significant strikes against to four. If you look at it for Emmett, strikes absorbed per minute, 4.02 to Ige's 3.82 given. So again, little discrepancy there. It's very, very tough to beat Josh Emmett, especially with a volume game. But I like Dane Ige with the movement, the fact that he can mix different things in. And maybe he goes out there and throws some kicks too. You'd like to see it out of him, especially in this matchup. Leaves you liable to get hit by the big overhand.
I will say this too. If Dane Ige decides to make this a wrestling match, I think Josh Emmett's going to win. I think Emmett is the much better wrestler. And the weird thing about Emmett's just knee and whatnot is you don't really have to worry about bouncing up and down on your knee if you're grappling. And if you decide to grapple with Josh Emmett, I think you're almost going to be doing him a favor in this matchup. So I think that's something to watch out for. If Ige is the one who initiates any of the grappling exchanges, it's probably because he's not liking something he sees on the feet. And that might play into Josh Emmett's game even more.
Big time fight coming up this weekend. Both of us going with Hawaii's underdog 50K Dane Ige. But you let us know down below in the comments section who you have. There's no wrong answers until Saturday night, and you can tune in to Question Mark Kicks on Saturday night, 2 hours before the prelims. The final picks get locked in, and we have a fight companion as well. This is my favorite fight coming up this weekend. I can't wait for it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. It's holiday season, and you don't know what to get as a gift or stocking stuffer. Well, today's sponsor, Manscaped, has the tools to guarantee you win this year's stocking stuffer or white elephant competition. Listen, Manscaped is a leader in men's below-the-waist grooming and have served more than 4 million men worldwide. And if my math is correct, that's almost 8 million balls, give or take a few. Get 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com with code FNP. Listen, ho, 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 fellas. Naughty or nice, tis the season to perform. And listen, when we're talking about Fight Night Picks, we're talking about Manscaped. This is a partnership that's gone on for many a month. It's been about a year that we've been with Manscaped. And I have to tell you, out of all the products, and listen, I use them. I talk about them every week, but I use them to keep my locks nice and smooth. They sent me this here in the last, what, month or so? The 2-in-1 shampoo and conditioner. It's in a...
Wow.
That's metal. That hurts my knuckles.
I was going to say, hit them together.
You got the body wash, I don't want to nick them, but still, you get the body wash. The nice part about these two, and it says it right on there, ultra premium cologne fragrance refined. I really like the smell of their cologne. It's a little bit strong, so if you are going to use it and if you pick some of it up, maybe just, you know, spritz it in the bathroom and walk through it like they would in a perfume ad, but that's kind of how I go about it. Mine's actually in the bathroom right now, but I really do like those. So if you're thinking about gifting, I know these might be a little cumbersome, but you can fit it right down in the stocking.
The really nice thing, too, is that the scent all kind of matches. Like, if you have the cologne, if you have the ball deodorant, if you have the shampoo or the body wash, it all has a nice synergy to it. So it's not like you're coming at people with four different scents all the time. It all just blends together very nicely.
And listen, you already know it. Manscaped's best-selling product is a Performance Package 4.0, which is at the top of every man's wish list this year. You get the Lawnmower 4.0. Look at that, 4000K LED light. You can turn the travel lock on if you go 1, 2, 3, and then those LEDs are going up. I'm traveling this week. I'm bringing this with me, so travel lock is a must, and then I turn it back on. The other nice thing is you can take it apart with one hand or one finger, and then you can clean out the motor. You can grease it, oil it, whatever you need to do. You also get to pick up, Matt, the weed whacker, and I use it every single week. You know this.
Hit him with it. It still hasn't got dull yet. Wow.
Yeah, it still hasn't got dull, and there's a lot of nose hair in there, among other things. And if you get the Performance Package now, you're also going to get two free gifts, the Shed Travel Bag, as well as the Manscaped Boxers. So, listen, there is a lot to go out there. And listen, these are our picks for a Manscaped Surefire Win Stocking Stuffers. Number one, it's a Manscaped, again, 2-in-1 conditioner. Shampoo and conditioner. It just launched. Kill two birds with one stone. Number two is that cologne-infused body wash. I've got it right there. The Shears 2.0 Luxury 4-Piece Nail Kit. That's on their site as well. The Crop Mops Ball Wipes for your stanky balls. And the fifth one, their signature cologne. These formulations are all vegan, cruelty-free, dye-free, sulfate-free, and paraben-free. So you know their products are legit. And listen, make sure you hurry over to their site to ensure these wild gifts show up before the holiday season. And while you're at it, get 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com with code FNP. Whether this is for you or your partner, dad, brother, friend, get them something they will actually use and something that's sure to get a laugh. Get 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com with code FNP. Be the ballsiest gift giver this year with Manscaped. We have a giant main card coming up for UFC 269, headlined by Oliveira and Poirier for that lightweight strap. You're not going to want to miss it, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up this weekend. We have Sugar Sean O'Malley. He's taking on Howley and Paiva out of Brazil. And Matt, for Paiva, he's been such an interesting case. He fights on Dana White's Contender Series Brazil. I dare you to try and find it on Fight Pass. They make it very hard to find Contender Series Brazil, but he fights Alan Nascimento, who's now in the UFC. They had a hell of a fight. Like, that's a fight of the year contender on Brazilian Contender Series, but you're going to have a hard time fighting it. You should, though, because it's a lot of fun. It's back and forth. They're both very well-rounded. In the end, Paiva gets the nod. So then he comes into the UFC, and he loses two in a row. One against Kai Kara France by split decision, who's also on this card. One to Rogério Bontorin, where his eyebrow escapes him, and he loses by, what is it, doctor stoppage. He beats Mark De La Rosa by TKO. He fights Jaga Shumagulov, and he misses weight. So then he moves up the bantamweight. He fights Kyler Phillips, and he wins a majority decision. Now, this is where it gets interesting, because MMA media members scored it this way. There's 129-28 Paiva. There's 14-28-28s. And there's 129-28 Phillips. The judges scored it. Eric Cologne, 29-28. You have Sal D'Amato, 28-28. You have Chris Lee, my guy, 29-28. Matt, in that fight, Kyler Phillips won the first round 10-8. And Howley Paiva won the next two rounds because Kyler Phillips punched himself out. That's how that fight went.
Exactly. And this is very disturbing if you believe Howley Paiva is going to win this fight. Because if you watch the first 5 minutes of his fight against Kyler Phillips, well, Kyler strikes kind of like Sean O'Malley. He's got a wide stance. He throws a lot of unorthodox strikes.
Do they train together?
They do.
They do.
Now, this is another big point. Kyler had a close fight with Paiva. I'm sure he's going to be able to pass on some of the information he was able to gain in that fight to O'Malley. And I'm not the biggest O'Malley fan. I'm not one of these people who think, oh, O'Malley, it's like title shot or bust.
You don't have him in your profile picture?
I do not. But you know what I mean? It just feels like the conversation around Sean O'Malley is over is always either, hey, he's like a fight away from a title shot, or he's a borderline scrub, and there's no in between. There is a massive in between, though, and that's what I guess we're here to explain to you. With O'Malley, he kind of showed it in his last fight against Chris Moutinho. He doesn't need to go out there and just hit you with one shot to get the knockout. He can play the volume game. He can strike moving backwards. He can strike moving forwards. He has great cardio and really good takedown defense. I just don't know what areas of the fight Paiva can, I guess, take advantage of and make his own. Do I think he's the better grappler? Probably if he gets top position, but O'Malley's shown the ability to scramble off of his back, to be very active at least off his back, create a lot of separation, at least try to scramble. He's not somebody who's just going to, you know, lock down their guard and hope the ref stands him up. So I don't know what Paiva's going to do to at least A, get initial success in this fight, and B, what's he going to do to then gain momentum off of that?
The weird thing about Haliem Paiva, when he was at 125 pounds and he was making weight, he was a giant guy for that division. He was huge. Great striker, too. Like, he really is. Paiva is one of the better strikers you would find at 125. He'd be a ranked guy forever. But at 35, he's not a giant guy, and Sean O'Malley has a big reach advantage. Sean O'Malley has a big height advantage in this one. I mean, the reach, 3 inches. The height, what is it, 3 inches as well? And you look at the volume, well, Haliem Paiva has actually struck at a negative clip in the UFC, and Sean O'Malley, 8.25 strikes landed per minute, those are significant, to 3.59 absorbed. Now, for O'Malley, the loss to Marlon Vera is weird, because again, he still considers himself undefeated. He even came into our live chat and talked about it.
Who cares if he considers himself undefeated? He's not.
But in his last two fights, he's come back, and you talked about it. This is the thing that I like. Volume, 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 and then I finished the fight. Now, when he finished Thomas Almeida, that was like, hey, why wasn't the fight stopped sooner? And against Chris Moutinho, it was like, hey, why wasn't it stopped sooner? Because there was just so much of a give and not much of a take. Like, Chris Moutinho was just accepting damage with his hands up. And
he was trying. Let's not make it seem like he was a... Like, he was moving forward.
Yeah, he got the crap kicked.
I understand. No. But you can't say Chris Moutinho's just some scrub because he lost to Sean O'Malley on short notice.
He wasn't good coming into the UFC.
I do not care. You cannot look at that performance, though, and take anything away from Moutinho. That's a loss where you gain stock, if anything.
Oh, he gained Instagram followers.
No, he gained
a bonus.
He doesn't... No. He gains the respect of MMA fans and the community at large.
For getting the crap kicked out of him.
Craig, he landed good shots on O'Malley, too. This is like your Jimmy Crute Anthony Smith. He only lost because of the leg kicks. Like, no. There's more to a story behind the fight. You don't have a fight of the night without the other side showing up, too. And Chris Moutinho was able to land some really good shots at O'Malley, especially when the pressure got to him.
So when we look at this fight, you've got Sean O'Malley, who's back on the road to success. You've got Haliem Paiva on a big-time three-fight win streak. We look at the odds for this fight. Sean O'Malley is a big favorite in this one. He opened in and around a minus 330. He's minus 322 on best fight odds. Paiva opened a plus 270. He's plus 251. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt, I'm going to set the under over or over under jump-ins at 85% O'Malley.
I think it's going to be over.
Holy smokes. 772 total votes, 85% O'Malley, 65% by knockout for the 15% that have Paiva, 58% by decision, 28% by knockout. Matt, I think Haliem Paiva has a decent shot in this fight. I think he has a better shot than Chris Moutinho had, but I have a hard time picking him in this one.
You got to stop disrespecting Chris Moutinho so much. Haliem Paiva was a good flyweight, but he's not really a bantamweight. This is the problem. This fight reminds me a lot of when Rory McDonald moved up in weight to fight Gegard Mousasi. You have two fighters who are very, very similar in what they do, but one has the added advantage of like 20 pounds. Yes, Paiva's a good striker on the feet, but he's not as varied with his attack as Sean O'Malley. And O'Malley on fight night, I expect to weigh a minimum 15 pounds more. I expect it to probably be even more than that because O'Malley is as big as a bantamweight can possibly get. I do expect him to fight at featherweight at some point in his career, even if it's just a one-off. Like, he's that big for this weight class, and I do think that the size and the speed is going to be a very big problem for Paiva. I expect a lot of kicks out of O'Malley early, especially to help him keep that range, and then he'll probably finish it with the hands in the second.
If you can make that case down below in the comments section for either of these guys, we would love to hear from you. Haliem Paiva taking on Sean O'Malley, both of us going with the man who is repping Arizona in this fight. We get a big-time main card coming up. Two title fights up at the top. Amanda Nunes taking taking on Juliana Pena, and in the main event, Charles Oliveira taking on Dustin Poirier. You're not going to want to miss it. Just keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend. We have the former UFC bantamweight champion Cody No Love Garbrandt taking on the studiously nicknamed Don't Blink Kai Kara France, representing City Kickboxing. And listen, last weekend we had City Kickboxing in the co-main event, and it was Brad Riddell losing to his former striking coaching foe, I guess you could call him, Rafael Fiziev, in an all-time fight. But I have one bit of advice for Rafael Fiziev. Call out anybody. Anybody in the entire world. Don't call out Vince Vaughn. I'm going to disagree a little bit, and only for this. It's a good way to get people to know who you are, because this is why. If he called out Matt Brown, or not Matt Brown, wrong weight class. Let's say he called out, I don't know, Ally Quinta. No, I know he's just retired. Just a name. Just hear me out. If he called out X fighter at lightweight, because it doesn't matter and you're really hung up on this, it wouldn't matter and no one would care. When he called out Hespula, it got shared all over the internet and people started talking about him. When he called out Vince Vaughn, it got people talking about it because it got shared all over the internet. That's why it is somewhat of a positive if you're a guy like Fiziev, who doesn't speak English all that well. It's an easy way to get your name into the headlines without just using your fighting. Call out Tony Ferguson. But when it comes to this fight, we have the flyweight debut for Cody Garbrandt, a guy that's teased the move in the past, but he's had kidney issues, so I don't know what the hell we're going to get this weekend, Matt. Because, listen, I try and take fights at 100%. Cody Garbrandt, 100%, at the best he can be, at 125 pounds against Kai Kara France, at 100% at 125. But you can't always do that. I mean, it's the same thing. Josh Emmett's taking on Dan Ige. Now, Josh Emmett at 100%, we kind of mentioned it in that video, he could probably challenge for a title tomorrow against Alexander Volkanovski and put on a damn good performance. But he tore his ACL, his MCL partially torn. He had patellar tendon issues. He also, fractured his patellar bone and his tibia. Like, he's had so many injuries, orbital injuries, concussion injuries, that I just can't look at him at 100% fighter, or it clouds my judgment a little bit. With Cody Garbrandt, he's had issues in the past. Now, listen, he's had a weird run in his last five fights because he went balls to the wall against TJ Dillashaw, almost finished him in the first round of their first fight, and the second round gets finished. He goes balls to the wall in their second fight, he gets finished again, and then he fights Pedro Munhoz, and he gets finished the same way he got finished in Dillashaw 1 and Dillashaw 2, and then he fights Rafael Assuncao, who's like my guy Ronnie Yaya, a guy who is still good in his later years, also happens to be from Brazil, but at a certain point, Rafael also hit a wall with age and skill, and Cody goes in there, no loves him to death, and hits him with one of the craziest knockouts I've ever seen. So Cody's last fight against Rob Font, you would assume that to make up for the reach, he's got to throw power shots and wrestle, and he tried to do that. It just didn't really work out for him. So a tough fight against Rob Font, to then move to 125 to fight Don't Blink, whose fights either seem to end in the first round or go to decision. It's just such a weird bucket of muscles for me.
I think Cody Garbrandt's back is a lot more hurt than people have ever let on. I really do. I don't know if it is as much of his chin or his defensive strike. He just, remember after he lost to TJ the first time, he was going to go to Germany to get like that Regenikine stuff done with his back, and then he came back to North America. Joe Rogan talked to him about different options. Like, there was an injury there, and it was never really explained all that well. The only thing that I do know is that Garbrandt doesn't wrestle nearly as much ever since he has hurt his back, and he doesn't seem to have the same power. Now, that might have nothing to do with his back. It was a conversation that, oh, this guy had a very serious back injury. It's what prevented him from moving down to 125 in the first place. He was supposed to fight Figueiredo at one point. A lot of people forget this. Like, that fight was booked. It was ready. He was going to make the move down, and then he gets hurt. Brandon Moreno, we all know what happens. I think there was a serious injury there. I really do. And whether it is back, whether it's, who knows what it is, I don't think we are seeing the same Cody Garbrandt that we were seeing in the past. And the other athlete I always think about when I think about back injuries, and they're still able to be pretty much the same version of themselves, is Clayton Kershaw. I don't know if there's a lot of baseball fans out there, but he went from being like one of the greatest pitchers ever, hurt his back, and he was still really, really good after he hurt his back, but you could tell that it wasn't 100%. It was like 95% of what we were getting before. It was a really good silhouette, if you will, but it wasn't the exact same thing. And I feel like with Garbrandt, we're seeing a similar fighter to who we used to see, but I feel like at 30 years of age, he's taken so much more damage than your average 30-year-old with only, what, 16 fights? Like, it is kind of wild. He had such a fast run to the title, and basically, like, half of his professional career has been spent with, like, championship-quality fighters. So it is wild that he's this young in his MMA career, and he's already accomplished this much.
Kaikir France is 2 years younger and has double the pro fight experience at 125
That's
pounds,
wild,
mostly. So it is really crazy. With Cody Garbrandt, he's supposed to take on Deiveson Figueiredo last year, but unfortunately a torn bicep takes him out of that fight. So we get Garbrandt here against Kaikir France. Again, for Kai, you look at his 5-on in. I mean, Mark De La Rosa win a couple years ago, a loss to Brandon Moreno in a decision. He beats Tyson Nam by decision. He loses to Brandon Royval by submission in a wild fight. That was a fight of the night in two rounds. And then he takes on Rogerio Bontorin, where he almost gets finished in that fight, and then he comes back and he knocks him out. So for Bontorin, make the weight, bud. Just show up and make the weight. That's all we need. But for Kaikir France, very well skilled, very, very tricky, because guys can almost never really figure out the speed and the power, and that's what makes him really special.
Yeah, he does have that unique combination of he doesn't need one punch to knock you out, although he can get it done with one shot, but he has really good combinations. I think the big key for this fight is going to be how kick-heavy does Kaikir France decide to be, because if he does decide to use his calf kick, use his leg kick and body kick, especially early on in the fight, I think it's going to be a massive advantage for him, because the one knock against Garbrandt and his striking is that he is not a very kick-heavy striker. Now, I remember, again, the in-between between the Dillashaw number one and two fight was, oh, I trained in Thailand, I've got a new kicking game, and he did demonstrate that a little bit in the second Dillashaw fight, but it was very odd. We heard about the move to Thailand, he did make the move, he threw the kicks, and then it was like, okay, it didn't work in that fight, let's just never talk about them again. He's shown the ability to have really nice kicks in the past, but it's just not something that's in his toolbox. And it does suck to see, because if Garbrandt did have some of those longer range tools to just sort of keep busy and keep active before he can do his big flurries on the inside or before he can land that big counter shot, then his numbers would just look a lot better. Like, in a 5-round fight, he would be able to win one or two more rounds just based off his volume a little bit better. In this fight, I guess I'm gonna ask you two questions, and I think that these will be able to answer the fight for us. Do you think Garbrandt can be better at 125 than he was at 135? Or do you think we can only see about the same version that we did see at 135?
All I'll say is this. He's going to have a nice height advantage in this fight, but the reach is actually pretty close, which is weird. Kaikir France, I'm going to bring the graphic up. Yeah, he has quite a bit more in reach, actually. So that's what makes it really weird. I don't see, like, you move down in weight, and when we're in the smaller weight class, you move down in weight, usually give up on speed. Like, if you look, Jose Aldo, Rob Font last weekend. Rob Font was faster.
He was.
And his jab was great, and his combinations were great. Jose Aldo had the power. So, can Garbrandt move down, have a power advantage, and knock out Kaikir France? Maybe.
He's been dropped before, and it'll be really interesting. Brandon Moreno had a lot of success with his boxing on the inside against Kaikir France, and we know how good the stand-up of Kaikir France is, but if you have really fast hands, you can hit him with your combinations and get out of the pocket. Now, Brandon Moreno might have some of the fastest hands really in the UFC. I don't know if his boxing is as good as Cody Garbrandt's, just for pure technique-wise. I know a lot of people might give me a hard time for that, but Garbrandt, his boxing truly is, like, elite, elite, elite. It's just, he struggles when he's fighting guys who are bigger than him, who have that reach advantage, and that really was the key with the Rob Font fight. Do I think Garbrandt's that much worse than Rob Font, just when you look at all their skills? No, not at all. It's just Rob Font has some physical attributes that Garbrandt can't match at that weight class. So, I really do want to pick Cody Garbrandt in this fight because of his speed, because of his power. But this is the problem. When somebody moves from middleweight to welterweight, it might be 15 pounds, but that 15 pounds means a lot less for their body overall than 10 pounds does moving down from 135 to 125. I really do think that this cut is a big deal because you're losing almost 10% of your body weight right now. Like, that is a massive deal for someone who already only weighs in at 135. It just, when you think about the percentage of actual their body weight that they're cutting, this is going to be a massive cut for Garbrandt. I know he's not a big 135er, but still, like, a bantamweight moving down to flyweight is never a good sign. The last time we saw a guy do this, he basically didn't eat food for 2 months and just took, like, prescription vitamins, and it was TJ Dillashaw. So, I'm worried about the weight cut, honestly. I'm worried about a lot of the injuries that Garbrandt's had in his career. But when I do think about how his skills set up against Kaikir France, I think he is the faster fighter. I just worry a lot about his durability, especially he had a bit of a fragile chin up at 135. I don't think cutting an extra 10 pounds off your body is going to help with your durability.
I have a really hard time with this one. You look at the odds, Kaikir France open a plus 105, he's plus 124 right now. Garbrandt open a minus 125, he's minus 151 over on best fight odds. If we look at Tapology votes, 817 total votes, 56% Garbrandt, 59% by knockout for the 44% that have Care France, 41% by decision, 50% by knockout.
Do you want me to pick first? Because I'm confident with my pick all of a
sudden. 5 years ago, I had Cody Garbrandt.
Thank you. But are you also picking Kai Care France? Yeah. This is my problem with Garbrandt. I'm going to bring this up with Amanda Nunes, and I'm going to pat myself on the back. I hate doing this, but just hear me out. When Nunes fought Chris Cyborg, my whole point was that Cyborg's only fought people who she's way better than for the last, like, decade. And that means you don't really have to make any improvements because you're always better than the people you're fighting. With Cody Garbrandt, he has lost in some vicious ways in the past couple of years. Has he really grown to become a better fighter because of those losses? To me, I don't think so. I still think he's the exact same guy he was when he got the belt. Now, that's a really good thing because it did get him to a title shot. But to me, this could sound weird. It felt like Cody Garbrandt was built to beat Dominic Cruz, and that was about it. He was brought up through Team Alpha Male, trained specifically with guys his whole entire life, getting them ready for Dominic Cruz. And that was the whole story. It's, I've trained with four people who have all fought Cruz. They're going to help me with this information. That's going to help me get over the hump. It's almost like he got to the top of the mountain. It was like, sweet, I'm here now. There's not another peak to climb. Whereas you see other champions, they become champion, and sometimes they even level up after they get to that point. With Garbrandt, he was making all these improvements. To me, it felt like he almost got the belt a little bit too early, pulled a Teofimo Lopez and thought, hey, I've got the belt. I don't really need to keep on making those improvements. So I don't think we're going to see a better version of Garbrandt. I worry about his durability, and I worry about it a lot at flyweight.
Now, let's flip the script, because we got to give both guys their due here. For Garbrandt to get the win, again, it's speed, it's power, it's the wrestling. And again, we did see some of that in that Font fight. It just didn't necessarily work. Rob Font is a good wrestler, yeah, offensively and defensively. He took down Jose Aldo.
Yeah.
And he took down Jose Aldo, so you love to see it. But for Garbrandt, he's got to implement that complete skill set and not get caught on the feet. And for those reasons, it's just tough for me to see that 100%. The bicep injuries, if there's a back injury.
There has been.
Like, there's so many different things. For those reasons, I have Kai Care France. But if you have a good reason for either of those fighters, you let us know down below in the comment section. This should be an insane fight. We have this one as possibility of a fight of the night. This and Pedro Munhoz, Dominic Cruz. If you missed that video, go back and check it out. Big time fights at the top of this card. Nunes taking on Pena. You have Oliveira defending against Poirier. You're not going to want to miss it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend at welterweight. We have Hands of Steel, Jeff Neal, taking on the Argentine Dagger. It's Santiago Ponzinibbio. And listen, he had a late career nickname switch up. He had a litany of injuries that kept him out of the cage. He comes back, he fights Li Jingliang, and he gets knocked out. And everybody writes him off, including myself.
Not
he goes
either.
Out there, takes on Miguel Baeza, and turns back the clock and looks amazing. And listen, if we really focus on Ponzinibbio's last two fights, it's a completely different tale of two completely different fights. If we focus on Jeff Neal's last two fights, it's like the start of Slim Shady's song Without Me. Two trailer park girls go round the outside, round the outside, round the outside. You know why I say that, Matt? Because the last two guys that he fought, he couldn't figure out the distance round the outside. When he fought Stephen Wonderboy Thompson, Wonderboy was able to do great things with his range, which he typically always does. And then he goes out there and he fights Neal Magny, and listen, was the fight 29-28? Was it 30-27, Magny? That's neither here nor there. All I have to say is that Magny stayed on the outside and put a lot of volume out there, and Jeff Neal wasn't able to figure it out, wasn't able to crash the distance, and now he's on a two-fight losing streak somewhere where we haven't seen him in this category or in this spot in his entire UFC career.
No, we really haven't, and there was a point where Jeff Neal was seen as one of the best strikers in this division. Like, right before the Wonderboy fight, it was like, hey, if you beat Wonderboy, it's top five or bust, and you might be fighting Usman in, like, two fights. Like, that's what beating Wonderboy Thompson means for your career. Now, I think the loss to Wonderboy isn't that big of a deal. You lost decision to one of the best strikers of our generation, really. We've seen that happen before. Two other good fighters, and those other fighters have come back and looked really good. Now, I don't know if this is record time for me bringing up Vicente Luque in a welterweight prediction video, but hear me out. At least when Luque lost to Wonderboy, he regrouped himself, and he got better afterwards. And he's shown that. Like, he's a more crisp striker now. He's just got more confidence in his game. What I didn't like out of Jeff Neal was that he didn't lose to Wonderboy and then become a better fighter because of it. He looked really gun-shy against Neal Magny, and that concerned me because it wasn't something to do with his skills. I still see the same straight left. I still see the same head kick. I don't see the same, like,
You know, like, go out there and get it. It just doesn't look like the same fighter as the one throwing those techniques, although it is. It's just, he doesn't seem as confident behind his own power. There was a time where, when we brought up fighters and their ability to finish their opponent, the first guy we would talk about was Jeff Neal, because he would hurt his opponent, wobble them, and stay patient and disciplined. He wouldn't stay so patient that he would let his opponent get back into the fight. He would just be smart. And being smart takes you a really long way in MMA, but in his last fight against Neal Magny, he wasn't really able to bring the cerebral aspect into the fight. It was a lot of, I'm just going to be waiting, I'm just going to be waiting, waiting, waiting. And against a guy like Magny, you give him an inch, he takes a mile, because that's how good his volume and his cardio is. So for Neal, losing to Wonderboy, I don't really care. That can almost change your career and have some positive effects on it. What I don't like, though, is the fighter who I saw against Magny, because he wasn't throwing back, and honestly, that's something that you never really get back. And maybe that was just one fight. Neal Magny's a tough guy to fight. But when you're known as being that aggressive striker who moves forward, and you're fighting a guy who is susceptible to aggressive strikers who move forward, it's not a great look when you finally do start to give up space against them. And against Ponzinibbio, you know Ponzinibbio is marching forward no matter what. And yes, he might not have the best cardio, he does get tired as fights go on. It's not like he's not doing anything, though, in the first 2.5 rounds. He can throw volume, he can throw for combos, and he does have sneaky one-punch power. Like, Ponzinibbio has been this really weird case, because it feels like he almost made an all-star game in his, like, second season in the league, and then no one's heard about him ever since, because the injuries have taken their toll. Him not being active really has sort of, I don't know, put a damper on the Ponzinibbio hype. But again, leading into that Li Jing Liang fight, if he had won that, there was a good chance he'd be right back into the top 10 in the rankings, and we would have all just acted like he didn't have that two-year layoff in between those.
Yeah, fights. I mean, if you want to play MMA math, I mean, Santiago Ponzinibbio knocked out Neal Magny, and if you want to play it the opposite way, again, Jeff Neal's last loss is Neal Magny. Obviously, we're not a gossip site, and we're not going to talk about it a lot. However, Mark Raimondi reporting on December the 2nd, the headline, UFC welterweight Jeff Neal arrested on DWI weapons charges in Texas. Seems like the fight's still going to be going on. So, again, be interesting to see how that one goes out. Obviously, Jeff Neal and his, you know, legal team have their own say in that article. I'll link it down below in the individual video. You can take what you will. But yeah, for Jeff Neal, obviously, regardless of the outcome, it's still a tough headline, and it's not the type of news that you want to see brought up going into a fight.
He had a really good story, too. Like, Jeff Neal,
he almost died.
But not even that. Go back even further. He was working at a cheesecake factory to help pay the bills while he started fighting. It's just, it's too bad. You hope good things.
But now we have this fight. And Matt, when we have Jeff Neal, we have Santiago Ponzinibbio, we talk about this a lot. We wish that we could see fighters 100% and 100%. So for Jeff Neal, his last two performances, are they total anomalies? Or again, are we going to go back to that cerebral fighter? You know, I go back and I think of it. Remember when Jamal Emmers fought Pat Sabatini? Knocks him down, almost knocks him out.
Dives into that guard like a dolphin.
Dives into it, decides to go for his own leg lock, gets submitted, and hurts his knee. In a Jeff Neal fight, I'd like to think if he had his opponent hurt like that, let him back up to his feet and hammer away at him. Again, we haven't seen that in his last two fights, but he hasn't really had the opportunities in those last two fights to kind of show that off. For Ponzinibbio, again, the loss to Li Jing Liang after the long layoff, the big win over Miguel Baeza, those guys were trading in that fight. So it's just going to be interesting to see what two fighters we get in the octagon this weekend.
It will be. This is what I will say. Santiago Ponzinibbio still looks like the same fighter before the injuries. I know he lost to Li Jing Liang, but that's not because he's fighting in a different style. He just pulled out of a close exchange with his hands down and got hit by a really big power puncher on the chin. That's going to happen to anybody. Like, okay, Khamzat Chimaev is a bit of an anomaly because everybody who decides to fight him ends up losing, like, horribly. But I do think Ponzinibbio is still a very similar fighter to the one that was in his prime. I don't believe he still is in his prime, but I think he's more like, he's chipping on the 11th hole. He's not on, like, the 17th thinking about what he's going to do after the golf game's done. I still think there is a little bit more tread left on the tires. This is what worries me, and I'll say this for both sides. They have opposite stances, which is going to open up their opponent's best strikes. Jeff Neal's going to have the left kick to the body wide open for him a lot in this fight. But what I will say is that Ponzinibbio does a good job defensively with his kicks. He's really good at getting his shin on the outside, doing it with leg kicks and body kicks. I remember vividly when he fought Nordine Taleb in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. He was doing a really good job at checking those low leg kicks from Nordine, because Nordine Taleb
if you're new to the UFC, probably you don't know who he is, but he was a very, very talented striker, especially on the outside. And Ponzinibbio at least proved in that fight that defensively he can be really sound, and that's a focal point of his game plan. And I think if he can replicate a very similar game to what he did against Taleb, oddly enough, I think it will pay off against Jeff Neal. This is what I will say. If Neal's the one moving forward, he can have success, but I've seen Ponzinibbio strike off his back foot, and at least... not even strike off his back foot. Ponzinibbio will just kind of plant and fire with you. And if he does get into one of those plant and fire fights with Jeff Neal, I like Ponzinibbio a little bit more. I think he's got a little bit more firepower behind him. And I think he's got the better output, too, out of these two guys. With Neal at all, it is all these set combinations where it's like, okay, jab, left, straight. And then it's kind of reset, then I'll get back into it. With Ponzinibbio, he flows a lot more. So I just feel like he's going to be the more active fighter in the periods of inactivity.
Jeff Neal's overall career, all of his losses are to current or eventual UFC fighters. He loses to Martin Sanoh back in 2013. You remember that guy? He's probably gonna have another fight in the UFC. How crazy is that? He lost to Kevin Holland, and then he goes on his win streak. Bilal Williams, Chase Walden, Brian Camozzi, Frank Camacho, Bilal Muhammad, Nico Price, Mike Perry, you know, Triller Triad's own. And then he loses to Wonderboy and Neil Magny. And if you look at it for Ponzinibbio and you focus on that loss to Li Jingliang, well, let's bring up the other losses as well. Lorenz Larkin, years ago. Ryan LaFleur. And then Leonardo Mafra back in 2011. You want to focus on some of the wins. He beat Leonardo Santos, you know.
When he knocked out Court McGee, I like straight up felt bad for Court.
Wendell Oliveira, Sean Strickland, Andreas Stahl, Court McGee, Zach Cummins, Nordin Taleb, Gunnar Nelson, Mike Perry, and Neil Magny. And Miguel Baeza. A lot of wins. Not as many, you know, finishes lately, I guess you could say. But a great one in his last fight. Holy smokes, let me tell you. The odds on this one are at par. Out of the votes, 741 total votes on Tapology. 72% Ponzinibbio. 75% have him to win by decision. For the 28% that have Jeff Neal, it's 55% by knockout. I'm not surprised at all where this is lined. Like,
no.
It's a 50-50 coin flip. I'm going to sit back and watch it. I've got nothing riding on this one. I love to watch these two guys go to work. You know, they just bring their lunch pails and they throw fists.
They do.
So I'm excited to see it. I have a hard time on the pick, though.
I think Ponzinibbio's left hook is going to be wide open throughout this fight. I know I brought up the southpaw kick of Jeff Neal being wide open as a result of their opposite stances, but what people don't realize is that Ponzinibbio does a really good job. He's very similar to Justin Gaethje. There's the other comp I can bring up, because after he's done throwing the right hand, he's got a great left hook that comes around right behind it, and something he catches a lot of guys with. I think that is going to be wide open against Jeff Neal, because the way Neal stands is going to be coming over his far shoulder every single time. And if Ponzinibbio can at least get the range on that one technique early, he is very unique in the aspect to where he's got a lot of power in his lead hand. I was hip to this early on, where like Poirier's right-handed, even though he fights like a southpaw. I don't know if Ponzinibbio is the same thing, but he does have an unnatural ability to hurt guys with his off hand. So I think if Ponzinibbio can use his jab to then set up the left hook and use leg kicks, he should have a great opportunity to beat Jeff Neal and really remind people just how good Ponzinibbio is.
It really is a tough one. I mean, Jeff Neal has the power. He can be reserved. He has a negative strike rate in the UFC, which is kind of strange. Both guys fairly close in terms of what they put out to what they receive.
Very active.
And very, very active. Good defense as well. I mean, Jeff Neal was 62% striking defense for Ponzinibbio, 63%. So we're really splitting hairs here at this point. I'm edging Santiago Ponzinibbio ever so slightly. But again, like, from now until question mark kicks on Saturday, if somebody made a good argument, you never know. That's how indecisive I am on this fight.
I feel like I have to bring this up every time we talk about Ponzinibbio, but I really did think he was going to beat Kamaru Usman when they were supposed to fight. Like, this is the type of fighter that we were dealing with a few years ago. Like, I know he was a big underdog in that one, but I think it could still happen. No, I'm kidding. But I really do think, like, Ponzinibbio was sort of destined to be one of those top five guys. It really is unfortunate that we did miss out on some of his prime due to injuries. But hopefully, win, lose, or draw, hopefully we just see kind of 100% of both guys this weekend.
Yeah, and for Jeff Neal, you beat Santiago Ponzinibbio, exactly. You're going to get a giant fight. I mean, it could be like a Masvidal. It could be like a Diaz in a big name. Like,
That'd be fun.
A really big fight.
Bobby Lawler, Jeff Neal.
I'd be cool with that, too. There's so many different fights you can make for both of these guys, but both of us right now siding with Argentina's own Santiago Ponzinibbio to get the win. Such a great fight. And listen, there's two big title fights up at the top. Amanda Nunes, Juliana Pena, and then Charles Oliveira taking on Dustin Poirier. You're not going to want to miss it. Leave a comment down below. Let us know who you're taking. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time title fight coming up this weekend. We have the lioness Amanda Nunes looking to jump back down to bantamweight for the first time in a long time, taking on the Venezuelan vixen, former Ultimate Fighter winner Juliana Pena. And I was brought up watching the movie Bambi, among other things, and I was always told, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it at all. This is going to be a short video, and I'm going to be polite, and I'm going to offer up opportunities for both of these fighters, and we're not going to get drug into the mud on this one. But Matt, I don't think Juliana Pena has a great shot in this fight. But listen, that's the start of this one. So for Amanda Nunes, again, since she's become bantamweight champion, since she beat Cupcake Tate Lowe those many years ago, let's look at some of the wins. I mean, her 5-1 in, Chris Cyborg, Holly Holm, Jermaine Durandamy, Felicia Spencer, Megan Anderson. Recently retired Felicia Spencer, too, so enjoy retirement. She just picked up a big win over Leah Letson. I was surprised by that news. But Nunes, her last time out when she fought Megan Anderson, looked amazing. And there were so many questions going into that
fight. She had her beat before they even walked in the cage. That's how good Amanda Nunes is.
But really, there were so many questions. You know, layoff, having a kid, like, what's it really?
She didn't have it.
No, but still, you know, becoming a mom for the first time. And they focus so much on that in the build-up to that fight. How committed is she to fighting now? Well, she went out there and proved everybody wrong on that one. So for Nunes, I have to expect the cut down to 135. It's going to be difficult, especially when you continue to move on in your career. But she's turned out to be one of the most, you know, consummate professionals out there. And same can be said for Juliana Pena. I mean, this is somebody that she's had, you know, amounts of inactivity in her career. She's a mother herself. She's had injuries. And really, through and through, since she's come back with a big statement win, you know, she loses to Valentina Shevchenko almost 5 years ago. Big time layoff, beats Nico Montano, goes out there, loses to Jermaine Durandamy, and then she beats Sarah McMahon to get her title shot. Again, I'm going to be a nice guy. She was supposed to fight Holly Holm in late spring, early summer. That fight falls out. And then instead of, like, giving her another contender, they give her a title fight.
So the issue that this division has is that there's three fighters who are better than everybody else, and there's one fighter who's so much better than those other two fighters, it doesn't even really matter. Amanda Nunes, there's a bigger separation between Amanda Nunes and the second best fighter in this division than any other division, than any other sport in the world, I might even go on to say. Like, there's a bigger separation between her and the second best fighter in the division than, like, Stephen Curry and the worst point guard in the NBA. Like, that's how big the gap is. Because with Amanda Nunes at this stage of her career, she doesn't have any major flaws. Because when there is somebody who is a minus 500 favorite, minus 1,000 favorite, you sort of do have to nitpick and think, okay, what are their few weaknesses if they do have any? And what could their opponent really do to capitalize on those weaknesses? So let's break it down really quick. What is Juliana Pena really good at? Well, she's a very experienced grappler. She has, I'd say, a smothering style, but it does open up submissions if she is able to really progress from guard to side control and get into mount. But she's not a great fighter off of her back, and she has demonstrated that she can get caught by submissions to less than great grapplers. Now, getting submitted by Valentina Shevchenko isn't that big of a deal. She's a very good grappler. When Valentina submits you off her back, though, by an armbar and full guard, I'm a little bit concerned about your grappling credentials when that's what you're billed as. When you tell me you're a grappler by trade, I'm the best grappler in this division, then it's tough for me to see you lose by submission to someone who's a weight class smaller and then to someone else who isn't even a grappler. Like, if Jermaine Durandamy has one weakness in her game, it's that, honestly, she's not the best defensive grappler. And she was able to get up or lock up a defensive submission on Pena, which, listen, I said Andre Muniz would never submit Jacare Souza. I didn't think Jermaine Durandamy even knew submissions. Like, that was such a surprising performance. And listen,
Utrecht, stand up.
I know that we have both talked a lot about how talented Jermaine Durandamy is and just how tough a fighter she is against anybody.
Wish she fought every other weekend.
It would be really nice. But the issue is, when you lose by submission, when you are a submission specialist to someone who doesn't go for any submissions at all, it's putting a little bit of doubt into my head that you can go out there and out-grapple someone who's demonstrated the ability to out-grapple pure grapplers. Amanda Nunes not only outboxed Misha Tate, she out-grappled her and rear-naked choked her. She didn't just beat Jermaine Durandamy. She took her down, ground-and-pounded her for 20 minutes, and then just really implemented her physical game onto her. If you want to go back further, look at what Amanda Nunes did to Jermaine Durandamy the first time they fought. Got into mount, ground-and-pound elbows, finished the fight. Okay, so we're just talking about the grappling right now, and that's where Pena would have the most success, you would think. Let's talk about the stand-up.
Look at that fight against Nico Montano, and look at the picture of Juliana Pena with her hand raised, and her left eye is swollen to bits.
Exactly. And it's nothing against Nico Montano. Honestly, she is a much better fighter than most people will ever even know, but she's not Amanda Nunes. Like, Amanda Nunes head kicked Holly Holm and knocked her out with a head kick. And when Joe Rogan said, hey, why'd you head kick her? She said, well, she's known for it, so I want to hit her with her own move. You're that good that you can beat the second best fighter in the division with her own signature move just because you thought it would be cool. Like, this is the type of fighter we're talking about with Amanda Nunes. I'm not trying to take anything away from Juliana Pena, but I honestly think Amanda Nunes could probably defend her 145 and 135 title in the same night.
Both of us going with Amanda Nunes in this fight. If you're putting money on it, you're a goofball. Because, I mean, Nunes is, she opened a minus 800 favorite. It's not worth it. Just watch it. You know, hang out and get ready for the main event. Charles Oliveira is taking on Dustin Poirier. You talk about excitement levels, it's right here. We have a fight companion coming up this weekend where we'll cover this fight, but also that one and the rest of the fights on the main card. You're not going to want to miss it with UFC 269. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Finally, time for our main event of the evening, UFC 269, Charles Oliveira versus Dustin Poirier. Crazy to think that the experience between these two guys, they never fought each other at lightweight or in their time at featherweight. And really, I went down through the list. These guys have a combined 29 bonuses between them. It's absolutely insane. They are bonus machines. And it's crazy because not that long ago, Charles Oliveira was beating guys like Jared Gordon and Nick Lentz. You know, the coach at Sanford MMA, and all of a sudden he's going out there, he's beating Tony Ferguson to a pulp, he's knocking out Michael Chandler, like crazy stuff, and a crazy progression evolution from the Oliveira that we knew was kind of a 50-50 fun fighter at 145 when he came in, to this lightweight mauler who's kind of teased a return to featherweight, but we all hope that that doesn't happen. He's taking on one of the greatest lightweights that lives on this planet. You have Louisiana's own Dustin Poirier. The guy fights like his hot sauce. It's a lot of fun to watch.
It's in your face.
And sometimes I shoot it on the camera. Not really, but yikes, man. Don't do hot sauce shots, especially as dares. But when I watch Dustin Poirier,
you're the only
fight,
person who ever brings it up. You're like, hey, guys, you must see me shoot hot sauce? Don't complain about it.
I'm a wild man. Let's go! But really, when I watch Dustin Poirier fight, I mean, it's absolutely amazing. His 5-on-in, the one loss to Khabib Nurmagomedov. Was it going to be retirement? Like, there were some negative things that came out of his own mouth after that fight. So he comes back, he beats Dan Hooker, he beats Conor McGregor, and now we're here. So I just kind of forget about the McGregor-ness. I look at that Dan Hooker fight. That fight was absolute madness. And listen, if this fight is anything like that fight, I can't wait.
Hey, this fight's going to be, I think this is going to be fight of the year. Mark it down right now. Whoever's keeping track at home, I think this will be your fight of the year. And I know we say this all the time, oh, we're not fans of guys. Like, Dustin Poirier, I remember watching Fightville in grade 9. I was there. No, I wasn't there. I wasn't in Louisiana. But I remember watching that movie when I was really young. And it was just wild to me that now he is now fighting for a UFC title. It's just a wild, just sort of life arc, I guess. Not even career arc. Just to see how far he's come from being that, like, kind of chubby kid in Louisiana to be one of the best fighters in the world. I thought Clay Guida was going to beat Charles Oliveira, and I haven't picked against him since. And I feel like I deserve a little bit of credit for not being against him since, because I feel like we sort of have read the rise of Charles Oliveira in the right way. Like, we both thought he was going to beat Chandler. We both thought he was going to beat Tony Ferguson. If you've been watching and if you've been keeping track, like, Oliveira's always been this special talent. It always was just like, and you hate to say stuff like this, but it was the mindset, the confidence. Yeah, it was just, it was all the sort of mental aspects. And it was less about how good he was physically. And on this run that he's gone through, I know I brought this up about Ciryl Gane a lot. It was, hey, I'll believe in him once I see him face adversity. Then he fought Alexander Volkov, got hit clean, and looked really good afterwards. So now I trust his ability to face adversity a lot more. Oliveira kind of did that in his last fight, too. Gets hit by a bomb from Michael Chandler, goes down, pulls guard, fights in a really intelligent manner, too. And I think that has to be said. He didn't just get hit and then kind of panic. He got hit, went to his back where he feels the most comfortable, and he knew, okay, if Michael Chandler is on top of me, it might not be the best position for me, but no one in the world is better at defending themselves from a position like that, or at least initiating a scramble, than Oliveira. So it just showed kind of that next level fight IQ, and this is something that gets thrown around a lot, but it is the truth for Oliveira. He's got that championship confidence now. Like, Charles Oliveira and Brandon Moreno, for some reason, the second they got their title, they were like, hey, I'm a pretty cool guy, too, and they sort of,
It just sort of gave them the confidence to let their personality out a little bit more. And that's great to see from Oliveira, who always felt like a bit of an afterthought at featherweight and lightweight. It's really nice to see him finally get his dues.
Well, that's it. I mean, you look at Charles Oliveira on the street. I mean, he looks a little bit like Craig Allen. He's got the nerdy glasses on. Guy. You know, he looks kind of quiet, just whatever. Thin. The thing that I love to see about Oliveira, and the UFC focused on this for two fighters. They both happen to be Brazilian, but it happens all the time. When Deiveson Figueiredo became champion, it's Team Figueiredo. My brother's in the UFC. I'm bringing up all my training partners. I'm helping fund everybody. Oh, by the way, I cut hair and make sushi. I'm the most interesting man in the world. Charles Oliveira was the same thing when he was going to fight Michael Chandler. I'm making these big paydays. I've earned all these bonuses. Everybody in my team eats well. I really, really support my guys. I love to see that. Dustin Poirier is the same type of guy. With his foundation, with all the charitable work that he does, these guys are two of the best guys in the UFC.
Yeah, really. This is a fight where you don't want either guy to lose. One guy has a massive charity where he tries to help kids, and the other guy, like, hands out turkeys in Brazil on Thanksgiving and whatnot. Like, these are great people, and that has to be said. Now, here's the bad part. Could I tell you who's going to win and who's going to lose? Dustin Poirier had a quote on the Errol Hawani show a couple weeks ago, and I thought it was a really, really good point that he brought up. And this is, I've gotten so many side rants this episode. Poirier has been asked a lot of, like, oh, you're the favorite in this, even though you're the challenger. Are you overlooking Charles Oliveira? For years now, Dustin Poirier has been saying that Charles Oliveira is one of the top guys in this division. And I think that does have to be said, because it's not like this is like, oh, now he's the champ and this is a big surprise. Like, Poirier, it always feels like, has had his eye on Oliveira as, hey, if he can ever put it all together, he really will be a threat. And he's always given him a ton of credit in the media of, like, hey, this is a guy who's got to the top, got himself beaten down, and then worked his way back up. And honestly, that means more than just, like, having a really smooth sail the whole way throughout your career. So I don't think Poirier is going to be overlooking Oliveira. But the quote that I want to get to is that Poirier said, fighting me for 25 minutes is a really, really hard thing to do. Like, he's hurting you with every shot he's throwing. He doesn't get tired. He's got a really good chin. There's just an accumulation of damage when you're fighting Dustin Poirier that you kind of have to account for. You will not be the same guy in round 5 that you were in round 1. You know how I know that? Because Max Holloway, the poster boy for I'm the same guy in round 1 as I am in round 5, had a really hard time eating the power of Poirier. And Holloway was able to get some of his own combinations off and was able to start getting some volume off. But when he would eat the power of Poirier, you could just tell that it was like, it was something different. And the thing about Dustin is that he doesn't just have big power or big speed. He's got great timing on the in-betweens. He likes to wait and counter-strike. And his boxing's probably the best in the UFC. I know he said it was Piotr Jan's, but when you see the way he's able to throw his combinations and really go downhill with his combinations, it's tough to beat him. When he gets guys up against the cage, going body, going head, there's few people just in the UFC who can put the boxing combinations together like Poirier.
The thing that you love to see out of Poirier, too, the left-handed right-handedness that he shows in the cage, which might sound silly, but you look at it. I mean, he's ambidextrous, but also he fights to the opposite of his strengths, which is really weird, but he's so good at it. The other thing about their stand-up, Dustin Poirier, a little bit more compact in his striking. He, again, you mentioned it. He's good in the in-betweens. He's definitely great in the clinch. Charles Oliveira can do it in so many different ways, and that's what makes him so special. He's the Swiss Army knife of this division. Is he good with his takedown attempts? Yeah, he's pretty good at them. But if you take him down, he can submit you off his back. You do not want to play on the ground with Charles Oliveira. But on the feet, he's such a hard time. And the other thing is, you talk about great Muay Thai in this division. Oliveira might have the best. And again, now I'm starting to really nitpick because this guy's the champion. I mean, he deserves all the credit in the world. Like, he is such a good fighter. And he didn't get to this. And somebody might tell you this, and you can take this to the party. This guy didn't get here by mistake.
No.
Again, he's an underdog. He fought, you know, maybe not the best lightweights for a run. The Jared Gordons, the Nick Lentz, whatever.
He finished them, though.
He finished them, and he went on, what was it, a 6-fight finish streak? Like, it was absolutely amazing. Then he beats Tony Ferguson.
Almost submitted him in the first round, too.
Made him look human, and then he beats Michael Chandler, where he faces adversity in that first round, but in the second round, he roars right back. So again, Poirier opened a minus 165 favorite. He's still there. And for Oliveira, he opened a plus 135 favorite. We'll throw it on over to the Tapology votes just to see where they're at. They're close enough. 850 total votes, 61% Poirier, 81% by knockout for the 39% that have Oliveira, 75% by submission. Again, for Dustin Poirier, last time he lost by submission was to Khabib. If you look at it for Charles Oliveira, the last time he lost by knockout was Paul Felder.
Paul Felder, yeah.
It was Paul Felder back in 2017. Both things are likely. This is going to be an amazing fight regardless. This is a wild fight because Oliveira could win by knockout, submission, or decision, and Dustin Poirier could win by knockout, submission, or decision. Like, that's how good both of these guys are. And some people out there might be raising an eyebrow, like, wait, Poirier could submit Oliveira? Yeah, Anthony Pettis did. And, like, Dustin Poirier is probably the most... It really sounds like I'm trying to pump up the tires of Poirier, but it's true. He's one of the more underrated grapplers in this division.
Look at what he did to Anthony Pettis.
Exactly. Look what he did to Dan Hooker, too. I know Hooker got submitted by Islam Makhachev, but, like, Poirier swept him with a go-go plata and then got into mail. That's, like, really, really high-level stuff that just, like, your average purple belt or brown belt couldn't do. Like, Conor McGregor wouldn't be able to do that against a guy like Dan Hooker, whereas Poirier can really mix in his jiu-jitsu and make it a threat in his fights. I'm going to bring up the training partner factor because I think this is an important one. Dustin Poirier and Mateusz Gamrot, they seem like they've been training together a lot in preparation for this. And I think I know why. Charles Oliveira goes for a lot of body lock takedowns and a lot of high single legs. What does Mateusz Gamrot do almost better than anybody?
Those and ankle picks.
Exactly. But he's somebody who's so good at wrestling and who is so good at that clinch wrestling, but also in a traditional sense, that I think he is the perfect guy to get you ready for Oliveira's style of wrestling.
And the scary thing about it, too, you bring it up just for this fight, but since Mateusz Gamrot's made the move to ATT with Boris Mankowski, who's got a big title fight coming up with KSW, is... these guys have been linked since Gamrot got there. It wasn't just, oh, we're getting ready for this Oliveira fight. Like, we've been talking about Gamrot, well, since KSW, but since he's been in the UFC, we've linked Poirier and Gamrot.
Like, think about how good their training sessions together would be. Plus, Jorge Masvidal is there. Like, American top team, especially for their top-tier athletes, must be the best place in the world. Because you've got top three, top five fighters from every single weight class who are all going to be helping each other every day. I just think... the Gamrot X factor cannot be overlooked because he offers a very similar look to the wrestling that Oliveira will do. It's not like Poirier is just training with, like, oh, he's with Jordan Burroughs right now, who, yes.
Bone Nickel.
Yeah, whose wrestling on paper might look better, but it's the style in which they use their wrestling. And I really do think that Gamrot and Oliveira, in the way that they get their takedowns, are extremely similar. And that's going to be a huge factor in this fight. Last point. Poirier is the much more active guy on the in-betweens, and I think that's going to be the X factor for this fight. Oliveira is great when he does the big action. When he does drop you, he can finish you quick. When he does take you down, he can get to your back very fast. But he isn't the most active guy on the in-betweens. He will wait for the counter a little bit on the back foot. He'll kind of let the fight come to him until he feels comfortable, and then he'll start to let off with his own attacks. I think if you get behind against a guy like Poirier, it's going to be really hard to get any of that back because... he doesn't have bad cardio, even though he's going to be huffing and puffing from the first 3 seconds of the fight. Again, pat myself on the back. Because for some reason, Joe Rogan's always like, oh, he's breathing heavy. He's breathing heavy. But if you've watched Poirier fights, like, he throws one combination and starts going like, and you get really nervous. But if you've watched enough of them, he's got great cardio. So both guys come in by knockout. Both guys come in by submission. Both guys come in by decision. Who's your pick, Craig?
I like the defensive grappling of Dustin Poirier in this fight as the big X factor. It doesn't necessarily have to do with the Gamrot connection, but you're only going to sharpen your tool right there, especially if you have a guy like that in your corner. And listen, UFC 268 was UFC Trevor Whitman, if you want to call it that. I think UFC 269 is AEW's Dan Lambert. I just keep seeing that donkey all
and
over Ponce Twitter.
And Ponzinibbio trains there, too. I forget, like, there's multiple fighters even on this card who are all going to be making the move together. So that's an even better sign.
We'll see what happens. But for me, I have Poirier in this fight. I think Oliveira's got a great shot. I can't wait for the fight companion on this one. Because, listen, I can continue to build this fight up, but I'm only going to get more excited as the week goes on. I've got Poirier in this one.
Charles Oliveira might be the scariest, non-intimidating man walking the face. It's like him and Ryan Hall. They just look like normal guys. But you know that if given the opportunity, they could tear you limb from limb. It would be really nice to see Charles Oliveira go on some kind of massive run, get Khabib out of retirement, then we get like the two best grapplers in lightweight history against each other. That's never going to happen.
What
but still,
Islam?
Even that fight, that'd be very good too. I just think the boxing and the overall takedown defense of Poirier is going to be a big X factor in this fight. And even if he doesn't get the knockout early in this matchup, he's still going to be able to land those big power shots in the third, fourth, and fifth round because he's shown the ability to do so in the past. Like, he knocked out Justin Gaethje after a grueling fight in the fourth round. Charles Oliveira, he can finish you, but he really is that, okay, I'm either going to knock you out or submit you in the first two, and then I'll try to out-technique you in the last three. So I like Poirier in this, but this is as good of a title fight as we've ever gotten in the UFC.
Both of us going with Dustin Poirier in your main event. If you missed any of the videos, make sure you go back and check them out. You already know the scoop with Fight Night Picks. If any fight drops out or if any are added throughout the week, we will update you as soon as we possibly can. We have question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims with a fight companion going live as soon as that main card kicks off. You want to join it, have some fun, have your say in the comments section, and let us know who you have on this card as well. Fill it up, because we have a big time end to this year. Your prediction MVP is going to be decided in this month, and it's a very, very tight race. You're not going to want to miss any of it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it.